of two alarm maintenance, debt service, and a water treatment plant. Some of these reductions reflect organizational restructuring, while others reflect changes in operating needs and project timing. We've added two new budget lines this year to our proposed budget, finance and public information officer, to give better clarity and align it to our internal operations. While some increases do appear, particularly in depreciation and wastewater treatment, the overall impact is a leaner, more transparent budget with a stronger long-term posture. We'll walk you through the major revenue and expenditure changes this morning, highlighting the positive trends and address a few areas that warrant attention as we move forward towards our final adoption. Okay, moving on to our background today as far as just a brief overview of the budgeting process and schedule. As the board is aware, and I covered this last time, the annual budgeting process is a continuous involving coordination across departments and key milestones. This process starts in October of the previous year and finishes up in April or May as we work towards a budget public hearing. And then by June 30th, we need to finalize budget for the upcoming fiscal year. It must be approved by the board. So as we are sitting here today, we're in good shape with our February, March finance committee meetings today. Should we finalize it today, that would be great. If not, we'll bounce back and have another meeting. We've tentatively scheduled the public hearing that is required for this at the April 14th board meeting. So that is coming up. That's our next board meeting that we have. And of course, if we do or are able to hold that date, then there's also a required public hearing publication that we must post out in the newspaper and notification at least 10 days prior to that. And traditionally, what we've done with the budget public hearing is review the entire budget that the Finance Committee has recommended with the entire board, review that, and then we hold a public hearing. So that gives the opportunity for all the board members to be informed with a recommendation of the operating budget. It gives any audience members an opportunity to hear and see the entire budget as well and be able to observe and listen to the board members' comments regarding the budget. Hold the public hearing, and then what we've seen in the past is that following the public hearing, we wait until the next board meeting in May, usually 30 days, and that gives an opportunity for our representatives, our board members, to go back to their respective communities and have a discussion about the budget as well. So that's the typical timing. And if we hold that schedule this year, we would have our public hearing at the April board meeting, and then we would turn back and have in May the potential to have an adoption of a budget at that point. So that's pretty much how we lay out this year, which is pretty consistent with how we've done it in the previous years. And that seems to work very well for all of us because it is a huge task and a great goal to get the budget done so that we can focus on moving forward and closing out the current fiscal year. And there's always a lot to do for our finance department, closing out the actual fiscal year as we get ready for the next fiscal year. Any questions or comments from committee members about what I've covered here so far? None? Okay. Team members, anything that you'd like to add? No? Okay. You want to emphasize all the work that you have to do at the end of the fiscal year and getting ready for the next fiscal year, right?
That shows on my face.
Okay, that shows. That shows. All right. Very good. So let's just turn on to our goals for today's meeting, item number 7, and that is to provide the Finance Committee with a comprehensive review of the proposed FY26-27 budget, enabling them to issue a recommendation on the final draft of budget. Hopefully we can achieve that moving through. All right. So we're going to move on to item 8, which is our current fiscal year budget ordinance review. So you have in front of you FY25-26, our current fiscal year budget ordinance. We always find it very helpful to start here just to give the Finance Committee members a view of where we are with this proposed budget ordinance. It also helps as we present to you the proposed fiscal year budget ordinance. It gives us an opportunity to kind of look back and forth and compare some values year over year. So this is the point where I turn this over to our finance director just to walk us through our current fiscal year. Richard, thank you.
Okay. Our current fiscal year, we won't go through the old ordinance in line-by-line detail, but just a broad overview. Most of the board members and the finance committee members saw where we were in the last quarterly update, so that gives you an indication of where we're at. In general, our total revenues were approximately $18.8 $1.6 million, but that included a $1.3 million fund balance used for capital outlays, or recall from last year's budget. We're, according to the quarterly update provided to the board, I think it was last month, water revenues and sewer revenues right now are running slightly above that, so we may see an increase in revenue for the year. And of course, we discussed interest income ad nauseum this year, that is still running higher than budgeted. So we're not going to see a budget deficit caused by revenues this year, I guess is the bottom line. Expenditures also $18.8 million in last year's budget. They're running right on track, as you saw from that quarterly update. We have no concerns about any department being over budget of the year. Any questions on current year ordinance?
So the interest income was projected $850,000 last year in our budget. Are we running close to that, or is it higher or lower?
Higher.
It's higher.
So the last fiscal year, if you'll recall, I brought you a budget amendment, and through the year we said interest is running high.
Yeah.
We're seeing the same thing this year. Why is that? Because we're passing, and we'll talk about this when we get to the current ordinance, because that is a continuing wild card, and even more so in the 26-27 budget. But we're basing our projected interest income on two things: account balances, which we're pretty static, we know those, but also interest rates. So you're taking what the economists and the North Carolina advisors are saying they project the interest rates to be quarterly.
Yes.
And we're seeing that the Fed has not reduced rates last year or this year as quickly as was predicted.
Right.
So in both cases, interest income, the rates have been higher. So we're seeing higher income. That's always a good thing. We're doing the same thing as we get into the upcoming budget that you're about to look at as a proposed budget. Same thing, we'll talk about interest income. We still use the economic forecast of what each quarter is going to look like interest rates. If the interest rates do not decline or even increase, then we could see a surplus of interest income next year. When we get into that budget, we'll also talk about how we could see a deficit in interest income next year versus what's budgeted.
So the non-billing revenue is still quite high. And has our automated system for paying, for the customers to make payments, that's not apparently being used as much as we thought it would be, and it's not helping?
That's a very good question. We're not seeing, so the automated system that we went into place with the new software approximately this time last year has some advanced payment methods. You have more notifications, you have some email notifications, you have pay by phone, which was a very high demand from customers in the past. But what we're seeing is that is not being utilized as much as we'd like, nor is the e-bill, paperless billing, being utilized to the extent we hope by now a year in. Ruben and I monthly, as we reconcile the month, we look at trends for payment types. What we saw, just to remind the committee, about 2 years ago, the committee decided to stop absorbing the convenience fees.
Mm-hmm.
And that used to be only for online payments. Customer, if you were paying online, you paid the credit card company fee to the third-party vendor, not to Sawasa. And last year when we implemented the software, we said now that same vendor is handling whether it's in-house or online payments, so the fee is not waived for anybody. If you're paying with credit debit card now, you absorb the fee, which goes directly through the third-party vendor. Sawasa never gets involved with that. So what we did see is a lot of people, so we thought that would encourage customers to just pay online instead of having to drive over here and pay on site to save that fee. But what we've seen is that has not been the case. It has been a trend back to cash and checks. So that is correct. And it has not, to your point, fees. Now, that has nothing to do with fees, the non-billable revenue. We have not seen a decline in the amount of people paying late or the non-payment customers, the traditional cutoff customers. We have not seen a decline in those numbers because of the enhanced payment, which I think is where you
would answer
the question.
So just to summarize, although we have a lot of these automated payment features,
and you have that additional fee for that transaction, which is very common for utilities and retail businesses. We see it everywhere. We do business with retail, restaurants, those type of things, card, cash or card, and that percentage, and moving to that fee, that online fee, which is, you know, transferred through our provider, basically, that's their fee. You see business being, foot traffic being driven back into the customer center for processing, which we were hoping that we wouldn't see that trend, quite honestly, that we wouldn't have to consider additional customer service representatives. But I think that if you look in the next 5 years or so, if that trend remains stable in terms of that foot traffic coming back into the lobby, now you have to start thinking about 1,000, 2,000, 3,000, 5,000, 6,000 more customers. And what percentage of that will use online? Maybe it's a different customer base, but what demand is that going to put on our customer service window and our staff? And the question will be, two windows, is that enough for our customer service? And now there's long lines and those type of things. So we have to be keen to that. So, and we are, we pay attention to those numbers, those values, and look at that. But remember, keep in mind that there is a cost based on those transactions. And again, it was a conscious decision made several years ago by the finance committee not to absorb those fees. It's basically, if the customer wants to use that convenience fee, that convenience, and there's a fee associated with that. So we continue to move in that direction.
There's been a lot of chatter I've seen, and I don't understand it, and that's why I'm asking, what is this extra $10 service fee that everybody is talking about, that Seguasa charges an extra $10 service fee? And I don't know what they're talking about, because we're not charging any extra service fees for making your payment. People were saying it was an extra $10 being taken out by their bank for paying online.
There is no flat service fee associated with paying online from Seguasa. Now, they may be equating that the 3% or I think it's 3.25% of the credit card company charges.
Yeah.
That could equate to about $10.
Yeah.
So maybe that's what they're talking about. There is no flat $10.
No,
there's certainly even a convenience.
We don't have a service fee.
That's correct. Yeah. There is no service fee charged by Seguasa at all.
I have a quick question. What percentage of people come in and pay versus online?
We don't have good statistics on foot traffic, how much is actually paying, because what happens at in the Welcome Center, the customer service area is paying everything, they're processing everything in the day that came in the mail, everything in the drop box, and everything in person. So now you've got three payment methods rolled into one daily count. Our system doesn't distinguish between when we enter a payment. Is it a person at the window? Is it a check via mail? Is it a check that was put in the drop box? So we don't have good statistics there. I can tell you how many are paying with a debit credit card, both in the lobby or online, because those statistics we do capture from the credit card processing company. And those numbers, so for February, the last full month, the number of online payments was 2,196. And the number of in-office payments using debit or credit is 284. So a total of 284. So a total of 2,480 people paid by debit or credit card in one way or another, online or in person. So if you take that number and say, well, 2,500 people paid and we've got 6,500 customers, about 4,000 people paid another method. That's customer drafts, where we drafted their bank account, which happens every month on the 5th. And there's no fee associated with them. And they don't have to worry about late. Some people use online banking, which transfers an ACH, a two-night ACH to us. The old days of them mailing us a check goes away, so you don't have to worry about online USPS delays that way. A lot of people have reverted back to checks, either dropping them in the box, bringing them in the office, or through the mail. And then, of course, you still got your cash customers.
So it would be easy to say two-thirds of everybody is using bill pay or mailing them in and stuff like that. It's only like about a third of our customers.
Less than a third.
Yeah.
If you contrast that back when we didn't have fees either at the window or online, we were about at a 33% payment rate back in the days when we absorbed the fees for both in-person and online. We were you saw that climb that each month we were having more and more people paying that method, which is today's, you know, that's kind of a trend for today, is most people don't pay in cash or check and most people don't pay in person. So we were seeing the expected trend, and we were up to, I believe, 35 to 40% in some months that were paying via that method. The fee switched back to pushing them back in the office, and then now it's further declined because of even in office those types of transactions and corrupting. But back then we were up to about 3,000 customers that were paying, and most of those were remote. So we saw when we took away the fee, when we put the fee in, when the fee was waived in the lobby, you saw a decline of online people, that they all came in the lobby. And we were hoping that trend would shift back for sheer convenience, but it did not. We have not seen that shift back.
So is it safe to say that the convenience fee is not affecting a lot of people?
It's affecting their method of payment significantly, yes. And we hear that on an ongoing and regular basis.
So if you're having a draft, does your bank still charge you?
No.
So is that a better way for us to reach out to the public and have it drafted?
We've encouraged drafts, and drafts have been in place. I put those in place right after I came on board in, I think, 2008-ish. We implemented drafts. We've never had as much participation in drafts, and it did increase quite a bit before credit cards became the prevalent method. And we saw that decline a little bit, and we haven't seen it go back up. A lot of people, especially these days with fraud and identity theft and so forth, a lot of people are nervous about giving any vendor their bank account information. And of course, that's required for a draft. So it's a safe method. It incurs no fees from us or your bank. You never have to worry about late because it's always drafted on the due date every month. But you have to also realize that a lot of our people, because we have a 60-day float between when the bill's sent and when you actually get disconnected from non-payment, a lot of people are not paying the bill. You get the bill on the 20th, it's due on the 5th. A lot of people are not paying it by the 5th. They're waiting and paying it, and they're floating for 30 days. So that a lot of our customer base does not want it drafted on the 5th because they want the flexibility of having that cash flow between the 5th and, let's say, the 30th before they pay. With draft, you do not have that flexibility. So I don't know that for a fact, but I attribute that to a lot of comments of why people do not want bank draft.
So, but there's a late fee.
There's a late fee. But a lot of people may need that cash flow for that period of time and would rather incur a late fee. And we do see late fee, as we said earlier, late fee revenue has not declined.
Mm-hmm.
If you'll recall, we raised that fee to $10, I believe, 3 years ago. And we anticipated that prompting people to pay on time.
I did that exactly for that reason.
And we did see a small decline for about 3 months, and then it creeped right back pretty much where it was. The same with the non-payment fee, if you'll recall. That was increased about that same time because we looked at a cost of service of how much it was costing Sahuasa for disconnections. And we saw that same 3 to 4 month decline. And then by the end of the 6 month, it was back in place with what it had historically been. So that fee that was not an incentive to change payment, payment habits, I guess.
So do you have on here somewhere where I can see the amount of money that is gained from people paying late or being disconnected?
I was going to say that non-billing revenue, that historically in the old days was late fees and non-payment fees, and that was pretty much it. Keep in mind now we have several other categories that are pretty large, tap fees being a large one.
Right.
So of that 640, but yes, to answer your question, there is nowhere in either ordinance where it breaks down those fees, but I can tell you what those are for the current fiscal year. So in the current fiscal year, I'll go ahead and give you both because you won't see it in the upcoming ordinance, and that way we'll kind of give you a contract. Late charges for this year's budget, 25-26, is budgeted at $230,000. For the fiscal year 26-27 budget, we're estimating that to be $240,000. non-payment cutoff fees in 2025, $100,000. The 26-27 proposed budget includes $110,000. So you'll see, to our point, we haven't seen a decline in those fees, the number of people getting assessed fees. We're actually seeing it creep up.
Really?
Yes.
When I got on this board, this non-billing revenue, and correct me if I'm wrong, but it's popping. It was in the 300,000s.
It was 300,000, and it still is 350,000 in the proposed budget.
Yeah.
But just 2 years ago, it was budgeted at 300,000. Now, I will...
It's going up.
Just for the committee's digestion, I guess, late charges is a little different than non-payment. And keep in mind that late charges is percentage-based or flat fee, whichever is greater. So keep in mind that should you have a shutdown of some sort at the state or federal budgetary level, and that entity is not paying on time, then you're talking about a large chunk of late fee assessed. That's not a residential customer or a typical commercial customer. So just keep in mind that that could be much larger, not just, don't think about just residentials. Just think about a $250,000 bill being assessed a 1.5% fee because it's late for 2 or 3 months. That can account for a chunk of that revenue.
There's bounce check charges in that too, right?
No. Bounce check charges go into a different account,
okay,
just to keep clean and to make analytical review. It's much better.
Okay.
It is in the non-billable revenue,
right.
Yes, but not in the two numbers I just told
no.
you. Right.
Can you give me the number of, you said a late fee is $10, is that correct?
That's correct.
And a disconnect fee is?
$75.
So
it used to be
50. It was 50, we raised it to 75.
How long ago did we raise that?
About 3 years ago.
I believe it was 3 years ago this July.
So in my thoughts, I believe we need to raise both of those.
Well, can I say something, Commissioner?
Yes,
when we'll pause on that recommendation, there is a point in our agenda this afternoon that we talk, or this morning, excuse me, 9D, we talk about review of schedules of rates, fees, and charges. So we won't get into that yet, but I will point out to you at your desktop, you have this covered. So a lot of the questions, some of the questions that you're asking about as far as those fees, they're in here. We can reference those if you'd like to look at those now, or just know that those fees are in there. When we get to that, we can drill down on that as well. So it's well established in this guidebook here. So we can look at other fees.
So would you rather me talk about that now or later?
No, I just wanted to make, if you're looking for fees, I just wanted the Finance Committee members to know that you have the full draft for all rates and fees that we charge that we can reference throughout this discussion. So if you have questions about system development fees, late fees, turn on fees, those types of things. But getting back to your statement about raising, we walked that same path several years ago thinking that we were going to change the customer's habits by increasing the costs, because one of the things that is very costly to us, and we try to keep our costs very relevant and very up to date in here for our services, is that when it comes to disconnecting services for customers, it's very expensive for us to roll the vehicles out to provide that service. And then for our team members at the Welcome Center to process that, and then we roll a team member back out into the field basically to turn on that service again. So anything that we can do to minimize that is really a cost savings to the organization, because it increases our productivity if we don't have to use resources to do that. So some of the thinking was, in the last couple of years, increase those costs to drive that business to those schedules, if you will, the customers, so that they make those payments. They're not paying an additional fee for that disconnection service. That's what we were trying to achieve with that by raising that rate. So just want to give you some perspective on that as well. I'm not sure if we've been successful, quite honestly, in that approach. I just want to give you that perspective. I'm not sure what the rate needs to be able to change that mode, that thinking. So any comments, Richard, from you and the numbers that you've seen as we've...
No, I'll just reiterate what you said and what we were talking about earlier. The fee does not seem to long-term change the payment habits of our customer base. And the only thing, you know, you see this from time to time on the news, an organization, a water and sewer authority of the city will try to implement a much higher cutoff fee. And then sometimes you get some public pushback on that, quite strong public pushback. So that's up to the committee and the board. But yes, we have not seen it applied in the numbers.
So the only reason I brought that up was I know it's costing soon to be $4 a gallon for gas for them to drive out. To cut that off, that's manpower, mm-hmm. the vehicle, the gas cost, the insurance, for him just to ride out there to cut something off. And then go back out there again and cut it back on.
And there's also a soft cost, to Scott's point, because the admin department, every time someone doesn't pay their bill for 60 days, the admin department, under the new software, it creates a whole work order for that disconnection. We have to monitor payments for 2 to 3 days online and in-house to say, okay, who has paid? You have to go in and modify that work order to say, okay, now they've paid. Turn the Mac on, and then the trucks roll again. So internally, there's an administrative cost to a cutoff that we've calculated in the past of 1 to 2 hours per cutoff.
But my way of thinking, for somebody that speeds sometimes going down the road, is the only way to get that person to stop speeding is to write them a ticket. And once it hits you in the pocket, sooner or later, you're going to slow down. So I'm just trying to reference, so if it continues to hit you in the pocket, the more likely you are to change your ways. But if you're not hitting me hard in the pocket, then I'm going to keep going.
And that was our thinking 3 years ago when we jacked it from 50 to 70.
I recall. And what I wrote down right here was $15 for a late fee and $100 for a disconnection.
Richard, I have a question. I know that when we had three more customers coming over to Sawasta, they had to fill out an application form. Mm-hmm. And on that, they were had the option of putting down their bank information, put it on draft.
Mm-hmm.
Is that a possibility if people are not comfortable doing it online, coming to bring that information to you?
Thank you for that question, because that's a very good point that I didn't think to point out. Sometimes when you've done this for so long, you forget to point out highlights that are important to the committee. We do not do online enrollment for drafts. So when a customer comes in, we try to encourage them. We have a form here that we encourage you to sign up for drafts. Here's how it works. It's all done in person. We do not, for security purposes, we do not take online drafts. So if somebody wants to change from paying my check or credit card, and I want my account drafted now, they can go to the website. Crystal has the forms on the website. They can fill out that form and then bring it in and let us proof their identity with a voided check so that we can ensure that we're capturing the account number information correctly, because there's been a lot of transpositions. And so it's secure. We don't take it just online. It's here in the office mostly. And to your point, it's not on our current application form, I don't believe, but is encouraged when a new customer comes in to open an account for them to sign up for e-bill, paperless billing, and for customer drafts. Most decline.
I'm going to use myself as an example. So several years ago, I've always had trouble getting my bill paid on time because it does come out earlier than any other bill.
Right.
20th. So when you say the 20th and then it's due to bill, that's a long time. I should be able to pay it, right? But using the example with other bills, usually it's mostly around the 15th or maybe a little later. So 2 weeks sounds like a long time, but it can pass very quickly before you know it, you have missed the date. And I did that. So I had to wait, I think, 2 or 3 months to pay every time before I could get it back online.
Mm-hmm.
So what I do now, I actually put a little extra online, and so I have somewhat of a credit. So I do not have to worry about it anymore. But that was from my personal experience, because it just escapes me. The first of the month, I'm not thinking I've got to get this. This is the only bill I got to pay the first of the month. But I think the state gets paid every month, right?
I'm
not sure.
So I'm thinking, I don't know, maybe they have the mindset too that I can wait a little longer, but they need to actually pay their bill as soon as they get their monthly check.
We do also have, I'll point out that with the new software, which we didn't have a year ago, we have the option for recurrent payments. So you can go in and say every fifth, every fourth, every first, I want to put my debit or credit card. So we do have that option that we used to not have, and we thought that would improve our payment trends, but we have not seen that to be the case either. People are using it, but it seems to be the people who are already paying on time.
Right.
Are using that option, not the people who are having trouble paying.
Well, I had preferred to put it online so I wouldn't forget, since it comes early. And I'm afraid that people that are going to be late, they're already late. I don't know if that's going to encourage them to do something like that, especially if they're getting their money at the end of the month. That's not going to be the first thing I think of that. So, I don't know, I guess we have a loop here that we're kind of in that we have to consider. But I wouldn't want to raise that late fee.
It will continue to do it.
Yeah. But I think you're going to just hit them in the pocketbook worse. I don't think it'll decrease.
Sooner or later you'll learn.
Well, you'll have to agree to disagree. Well, the other thing is when people are complaining about our rates being so high, if you constantly pay that late fee,
we don't have to raise
yourself. You're blaming Cibuasa, but it's not our fault that you're paying more money. I believe that in one of our finance committee meetings, we talked about how many people were there in habitual disconnects. We found out there were several, and one person paid when their phone water got disconnected every month. So you're paying an extra $75 every month.
Right.
And you're complaining about our rates. And I'm like, well, wait a minute. This part of it is not our fault. And you could save $75 a month if you pay your bill.
Right.
I know everybody can't do that.
Right.
I got that. I understand it. But that was the reason behind it. We thought we could save them the $50 or $75 if we raised it. But it didn't happen.
Right.
And of the disconnects, we are still seeing that same trend that you probably have. I'd say 75 to 80% of the. Would you say it's about 75% of the disconnects that are recurring?
Yeah, I don't have that number.
But it's a large percentage of them that are on the list every month. Sometimes you see the bill itself is $60 to $70, and now you're paying $75 fee on top of that. So you're paying more for the fee than you are for the bill in some cases, which to an accountant is always like, what? But
let's put the number out there. What was the, do you remember the count of cutoffs we had for the month of February or March? I don't think are we doing March yet?
No.
No, February.
We don't have March yet. That's next week.
Okay.
Just for context, December is always a low cutoff month. People don't want their water disconnected at Christmas. January, therefore, is always high because everybody spent all their money at Christmas and have no money. So that's the historical trend. For December, it was 116. For January, it was 167. And for February, it was 120. We have seen in this current fiscal year, 25-26, we've seen as high as 213.
We're trying to have them the best we can.
Right. So we agree, but it just seems like that number never goes below 110.
Or 100.
I mean, it would be fantastic to see that number less than 15, maybe 10. But over 200, think about it. Again, that's a full day of truck rolls and staff. And then something we did mention, I don't mean to pile on here, but there's some meters, we lock out the meters too. So we have to go back and double check that the meters haven't been unlocked and there hasn't been additional usage. So that's another truck roll to a site to go back around to the ones that never came back in and paid. And there's always a percentage of that as well. So
twice a month. So sometimes they're going almost like 4 times.
Right. So it's very challenging for us from an operations standpoint as well. Because again, we're looking at lost resource time for other projects.
Right.
So, All right, so I put a note down to discuss this when we came up to item 9C, but it's generated a lot of discussion here. Does the Finance Committee want to go to any of those pages just to review that in this fee book here, or have you made your decision about no increases to those areas?
No, we can discuss it when we get there.
Yeah.
Okay, bring it back up when we get there. Okay. Okay. All right. That was a lot of good discussion on non-billing revenue. Is there anything else on the revenue side or expenditure side from the current fiscal year 25-26 budget ordinance on page 5?
No.
All right. Well, with your permission, we'll move on to item 9, which is the proposed fiscal year 26-27 budget review. And those items include a budget message, a budget ordinance, and then 9C, the review of schedules of rates and fees. All right, so I'm going to talk to you about the draft budget message. And I'm going to read this to you, and we're going to scroll a lot of information. And the reason we put this together, it's somewhat high level. It's not quite an executive summary, one paragraph. It's multiple pages, but it's important because we do hit on a lot of key items here, including key revenue elements, key payroll benefit elements, so on and so forth. And then this document also becomes part of the package when we get to the public hearing as well in April. So let me just start off by saying the draft budget for fiscal year 26-27 is carefully designed to ensure it is balanced, meets the organization's debt obligations, and supports the annual operations of Sigwassa's utility system. Notably, the draft budget does not include a rate increase. Pause for applause. No. Okay. So keep moving. To maintain current rates, the budget relies on $342,511 of available operating fund balance to cover the unfunded portion of asset depreciation. The draft budget funds depreciation at 84%, which is below Sigwassa's target of 95%. So while Sigwassa remains in a strong financial position, funding most of its depreciation, the authority will need to continue increasing depreciation funding over time to reach its goal of fully funding 100% of depreciation in the near future. The draft budget removes bond anticipation note, BAN, we often refer to it, related interest revenue and expenses from the operating budget to avoid skewing operating results. The net cost of $651,000 will be paid from designated CIP funds. A formal budget amendment for CIP, capital improvement designation update for these items will come to the board in July 2026, following the closeout of our current fiscal year. The draft budget recommends adding one full-time accountant, one position, increasing the total workforce to 53 employees. This adjustment will shift accounting duties away from the customer service supervisor, allowing each person to focus on their core responsibilities. This position is fully funded within existing revenues with no impact on customer rates. To further strengthen customer service and enhance organizational efficiency, the draft budget also updates Sigwassa's internal structure. The budget creates separate finance and public information officer departments, improving oversight and budget management. Before I roll on to key revenue elements of the budget, are there any questions or comments from the committee members on what I've covered?
So finance and PIO were in the same department at
that? That's correct.
Okay.
Administration has always been all the exempt employees.
Yeah.
Let's say 2019, but because of course by then there were only three employees in that then. As we've expanded staff, about 2 years ago, we split out HR because HR became a new position.
Yeah.
And then engineering, we brought on an engineer, which we'd never had before in that position. So we split out that position and we decided this upcoming year just now that you've got several people merged into 7110, it's difficult for us to manage the budget and each department head manage their budget. So we split it out into two new departments. We had wanted to do that in 25-26, but we just ran out of time to do that in 25, 26. But that's correct. In 25, 26, you have five. All those three.
I've looked at it on your chart before, and you said it just now. I'm like, right. I never noticed that.
So if you go way back in time when Richard was here doing all of that, it was easy to manage. I just walked on.
When you're HR, payroll,
yep, that's right.
Engineer, everything.
And technology, he did it. But as we've grown, we basically want some financial oversight and budget management into each one of those disciplines. It just helps us manage better. All right, let's move on to key revenue elements in the budget. Revenues for the draft budget reflect steady growth consistent with recent system trends. Water revenue is projected to increase by $150,000 and sewer revenue by $200,000 compared to our current fiscal year. The budget allocates $2.7 million towards depreciation, funding 84% of the requirement and representing progress towards CityWatch's goal of achieving full funding within 5 years. Interest revenue is reduced by $200,000 to align with updated financial projections, and all fee categories were reviewed for cost of service accuracy, and no changes to customer rates are recommended. That's the companion document that we'll talk about in a moment. Key payroll and benefit elements. To support CityWatch's operational needs and maintain competitive compensation, the FY26-27 budget includes the following payroll and benefit adjustments. One position request to add, which is the one accountant, one position to strengthen our financial operations. In terms of our compensation adjustments, a recommendation of 2% increase to the classification and compensation schedule for all employees, up to a 4% merit increase based on performance evaluations. We have required state retirement contributions of 0.75% increase, employer contributions. In terms of our employee benefits at the bottom of the page, you'll see projected premium increases of 20% for medical, 10% for dental, and 5% for vision. Continued 4% employer match of the 401k for participants, and continued $500 per month out-of-pocket cap on employee medical expenses. So I will pause there, because in the past during our budget presentations, there's always been some discussion by the Finance Committee members regarding cost of living increases. And you can see from compensation adjustments, we're recommending a 2% increase. And then usually there's discussion about 401 participant employer match percentages. So I will just pause there to see what questions the Finance Committee members have on the key payroll benefit elements section.
I have three questions. First one is 401k. How many participants do you have that are participating in that? Am I asking you that hard question?
Nobody always asks this question.
Yeah, no, you asked, I got to get to it. I was prepared this year, you didn't trick me this year. I have it. Here, I looked at it the other day. 18 as of January 31st, when I started the budget, 18 participants of your 52 positions, but keep in mind you do have some vacancies.
All right. How many people do we have that's using the $500 a month cap?
Now, that I do not know. You know that from payroll.
Let me pull that up.
And that is always a wild card in the budget, because you can't anticipate who and what department's going to be. So you'll see a budget amendment coming forth in this fiscal year to reallocate.
We had two last year, right?
I believe we used to have two and then went to three, but I think that's substantially different now.
Three, four, looks like we have six currently.
Fantastic. I like it. And the last one is, so the projected is 20% for medical increase.
That's what our benefit provider, our benefit advisor, is. He gave us the 20% 10 and 5.
And when do we go back out for a bid on that? How often do y'all do that?
We start having discussions with our benefit providers, I would say September, October of last year, just so that we understand what's going on with the industry.
Mm-hmm.
And we've been able to appreciate here in this organization very low premium increases over the last 3 or 4 years. We kind of anticipated they might be a little bit more expensive this year. It's coming out to be such.
With our fiscal year started July 1st, we have to get through 6 months of use before they can actually give us some projections. So again, we pick up that conversation with our providers in January, February, March, and get those values. And Priscilla, our HR manager, Priscilla Adcock, is not here today for us, but she's actively pursuing that and also coordinating this with our finance team here to get these values on the page here as anticipated expenses or increases to our budget. Now, we have an opportunity once we move forward with our budget approval to continue to narrow that. We do go through an open enrollment period usually in May coming up so we understand how many employees are enrolling in what programs. Sometimes there are some reductions in some of our costs, but we find these values that you have on the page here to be very accurate estimates for what we anticipate this fiscal year.
It has been historical that the projected premium increases when we do the budget is always higher than what it finally comes in June or July when we finally get the numbers, it always comes in lower. Just constantly. We project high, they project high and give us a number, they mean the insurance companies. But usually Richard always comes back and tells us the premiums came in lower. So it's nice when it happens. I hate that we have to put this amount of increase into the budget when we know, well, I know after the years I've been on here that it always comes in lower, but you gotta plan for what they're telling us.
That's correct. And that's the budgetary approach. We always take the budgetary approach of the advisor's worst case, and then you hold their feet to the fire. You'll see that with PML and workers' comp coming up. You hold their feet to the fire to say, okay, that's not acceptable when the rates come in, and you start negotiating and getting them to go back to the drawing board. Sometimes you get lower rates. And I think all the healthcare notices that came out several months ago was, okay, this is the year. You know, every 2 or 3 years, it's a much larger increase. So I don't think we're going to see as low of an increase just based on market trends as we have in the past, but hopefully we will not reach the 20% to your point.
And when we started the 401k match, Kenneth, back when Tim was on, we started at 2%, I think, the first year I got on the board, but there was one person was doing the 401k match. And to be up to 18, we're doing something right.
I agree.
Back in 19, historically we had none, and then it was 1 or 2 for several years. We have seen, unlike talking about the revenues, we have seen the increasing match have an effect on participation. I think we can definitely say that that has an effect. You know, when you go from 1 or 2 and you start raising it by 1% each year, we now up to 19. So I think that has had an impact.
And our payroll conversion is all done, right?
Yes.
Ruben smiled.
Yes. I will answer that while they groan. Yes, is there?
Richard's got a furrowed brows. Ruben's smiling. What's going on?
Ruben looked that direction.
Ruben looked at Richard and was like,
well, if the
that was a fun response. Really.
Well, the committee and the board recall that we really couldn't take advantage of the post paid payroll system until we made some structural changes within the organization by the way that we were paying. And we worked on this project for 3 or 4 years, I believe. And in last year's budget discussion, and actually in the budget you will see, we spent a lot of time talking about how to make this correction, what the costs are going to be associated with making that correction. The board approved that approach, and then we actually went through that payroll implementation, that upgrade, this last fall, and rolled out the change in February, so last month. So we did make that change. We finished the final, we completed our final end of month or prepay, if you will, end of month in January.
That's first prepay.
And then as we moved into, was it the February payroll, basically, right?
That's correct.
That we did, February 15th. It is now what we call the post-pay, correct?
Correct. Right. So today, hopefully the board got their first post-pay after as an employee.
Mm-hmm.
Correct.
All right. So we're
some
now
of us got the notice February 26th, January, February, March, April, May of 26th, and thought that was the date because we didn't read the other column.
Mm-hmm. So yes, that was a major hurdle. So that now allows us for improved automation of our payroll system, which
just something that we needed, and that dovetails in now to the next phase of this project, which is the timesheet automation piece. So that piece is now, it's been started. We've been working on that for several months, and I believe we get into automation testing, piloting, and time clocks, I think, coming up in May, June of this year. So we're going to do that on a small scale pilot from department to department to bring resources on board. And I believe our target right now, the last time I looked at our schedule, was September of 2026 to have that entire project completed and everyone doing the automated payroll.
And then after that's done, will we go to a 2-week pay period? Or we're not even thinking about that yet?
We haven't discussed that yet because we're looking at, we want to complete these steps first and run the payroll processing to see how that works, and then we'll take a look at that actual processing.
Okay.
Yeah, okay. Right. So
that's the goal? Is that the goal?
That's Richard Retirement, that's the goal.
It hasn't been established as a goal yet, but we recognize that the things that we are doing will place us in a better position that we could achieve that in the future. So let's just say that it's on the horizon, but from our point of view, with all the software changes and upgrades we've made to financial systems and timekeeping, I think that we all just want to exhale in October of this year, November, to say, okay, how well is everything working? Let's let it run. And then we will have those discussions, no doubt, as we are looking at future years and budgets and goals for the organization. I think we're going to have, quite honestly, more focus on customer service operations this next year than we are payroll, and hence the reason for the request for a customer service supervisor and to start beefing up that area, look at some automation in those areas as well. So
where Richard wants another person in his department. Get a little bit, aren't you, Brock?
He doesn't really want it, but it's needed. It's necessary. So,
yeah. As we were talking about one person doing it all 10 years ago, mm-hmm. We're finding that customer service is a much heavier lift these days than it was 10 years ago.
With more customers, yes, it's going to be.
It's only going to
get. It's going to get worse. Yeah. But it's not just the customer base. I mean, back then when we took over Creedmoor, we were roughly 5,700 customers. Let's say we're up to 6,500 customers. That's a percentage increase. But the sheer amount of hands-on customer service, why is my bill so high, my usage is up, the number of calls we field, the number of emails we field, the foot traffic we were just talking about up front. We're just seeing the customer service is coming off a much bigger lift. And when you've got one person trying to do invoicing, payables, purchasing, in the accounting department, and that person is spending now 50-60% of their time on customer service related. And it's not just customer service, but billing with the new software has become much more time consuming. We're doing a mass meter replacement right now. You're talking about replacing roughly 2,000 meters, I believe. The billing team needs help with that. They can't do it and do the billing. So it's just becoming a situation where one person just can't keep up with that workload at all. And as you transition, Scott's point, if you're ever going to look at a biweekly payroll, you need a person. You're talking about now somebody spending 50-60% of their time each month doing nothing but payroll. You surely can't do that with a person who's doing 60% customer service, 40% AP purchasing, and now is going to take on biweekly payroll.
So all the automation that we've added is not making it an easier task. I mean, I know almost everything was manual in 2020 when I got on this board. There was a lot of manual and not a lot of automation.
Well, I will say that the implementation of the software, and Ruben, please speak up if you feel differently. It was a very difficult lift. The version of the software they put us on was an untested and we found out unreliable system. So it's been a difficult road with the implementation. Maybe the most difficult in my professional life. But we think we've got past a lot of the kinks, but the problem with it is now that we are so meticulous about catching any error. We're not, you punch the button and whatever it spits out is what it is. That's not the department I run, and neither does Ruben. So we're doing a lot of manual cross-checking. So we gained some time possibly on the front end with the processing time, but now we're spending at least that much, if not more, on the tail end now saying, is this data correct? Can we trust this data? Once we gain a year or two, to your point earlier, once you get a year or two of history behind you and you trust the data, then you hope to gain that time back.
It's also improved workflow automation for our departments and our department team members as well, as far as the online purchase orders, the checking that they can do now online, looking at budgets, putting requisitions in faster, which not just creates an additional workload, those type of things, but it's the move in the right direction, because moving to this platform allows us to integrate with other softwares as well in the future. And I think maybe many of you experience the same thing, that you do gain productivity, which is great, and then you find another software that links to that that creates additional productivity. Next thing you know, you've got 10 new technologies out there, and they're working together, which is fantastic. But it still requires some resource time to work on that as well. And something that we want to do a better job at is really our customer service area, in terms of working with our customers when they have questions about their billing. It's been my experience, brought into conversations over the last several years, that conversation could be a 2-minute phone call, or it can be 3 or 4 hours in terms of what's involved with trying to work with that customer. And that's what we're trying to do. And we can see that we're slipping in some areas that we need to have a better focus on: customer service supervision, customer service growth. And I think one of the things that we're going to be up against in the coming years, and something we won't necessarily talk about today, but it will be on discussion as we move through this year and prepare for next budget year, is we're going to grow out of the space up here. It's a small lobby. It's 2 windows. It's a small office. And you really, it's challenging to figure out how are you going to expand to 4 windows. Or 4 customer service reps or more that's going on up there. And as we're moving into meter, the meter change out, I'll just touch on that for a moment here, that we want to get all of our meters up to the latest and greatest for automatic meter reading and automatic meter intelligence type of thing. And so we're setting that platform. And what that's doing is, it's a great to get us to that level. It's going to create additional meter management needs for that billing, which, and again, that ties in with billing and customer service, and so it's meter management. So Chris, being in charge of the utilities team, is talking to me about, well, what changes do we need to make with our utility meter reader staff, and do they need to be realigned with customer service and billing, because they're really working collaboratively, to bring that information in and metering. So we are a growing utility, and we're going to have to stretch our elbows out a little bit here, trying to figure out what we're going to do and how we're going to do it with existing space, future space as well. That's not baked into today's budget discussions, but just want to make the board aware of it based on our 20 and 30 year planning scenarios with our growth. We could easily see the areas that, we are going to grow and we have to plan for. We don't want to wait to get there and say, this is what we need to do now. We want to grow steadily. And this is part of that campaign, as you will see, adding in person here and these duties.
And so, let me ask this question. It's probably not involved with the meter replacement systems that we're doing. And you've got some done already, and you're seeing how the interactions are working all the way through.
Mm-hmm.
With the new subdivisions that are being built right now,
mm-hmm.
those subdivisions are being built with these new meters?
That is correct.
Okay, so have we got 100% acceptance of these new meters? We're good with them. There's not a problem. I don't want to put new meters in everywhere and all these new subdivisions, and then 2 years down the line that, those meters weren't as good as we thought they were, and we need to change them all out again. So that's what I'm asking.
Right. So we during my tenure here, we had a conglomeration of meters out
right.
there, and that was just based on the fact that we were purchasing other utilities and bringing them in as a loss, so there was no standard. So we took the opportunity several years ago to develop what was the best meter for Sigwassa as far as the default meter. And we took it a step further. We said, okay, this is the best meter we believe on the market. What's the best technology in that meter? So if we're going to go with automated meter reading or different systems in the future, we want to make sure it's baked in when we put that meter in the ground so we have that capability. So, yes, we took that step and we standardized that meter. And we're very happy with the type of meter that we've selected, and they are going in the ground. So that's the best way to do it, and the replacement meters are the same. Provides us with some flexibility in the future if we want to take a large step towards even greater management, which would be receiving reads every 15 minutes, basically, from those meters, that type of automation, and providing our customers with more online information about their water use and leakage and those type of things. So that's several years away, but we're building towards that. Now, if the meter company would come to us this afternoon and say we have a major problem with those meters in production, and the last 5,000 meters we sent you, they're flawed, here's some new ones or the warranty, then we would have to consider that as well. But I think from what we know, and Chris, if you want to, I see him shaking his head, because I know that he manages this for us as well, that we chose the right meter.
Okay. We did. I mean, there's a lot of advantages to having this. You can get a lot more information. If somebody asks you for leak data, you can provide that information to them. There's no moving parts inside of the meters nowadays. They have a better warranty than the previous ones. So, I mean, there's a lot of advantages to what we're going with.
Well, I know that when we lived up north, there were rates for peak hours. And it was because of the meters that they were using. And we're talking 20 years ago, so I know the technology. Mm-hmm. But if you use a lot of the peak hours for Saturdays, Sundays, and in the evening, in the daytime, the water usage had a lower rate mm-hmm. because most people were working and they weren't using a lot of water.
Right.
But that's the way they did it. And I'm just thinking, can we get to that point maybe someday? I don't know.
Explain where do you want to get someday that they can actually see that demand or that usage?
So that they can find out what the peak hours are. I mean, there was a different rate for peak hours and low hours.
Oh, okay.
When I looked up there. And if you wash laundry in the middle of the daytime or from 9 o'clock in the morning to 3 o'clock in the afternoon, you had a lower rate than if you did that laundry on the weekend. Because it was peak hours and peak draw.
That kind of makes sense from an electric standpoint. When we were doing electric meters in another organization, I understand those demand fees and costs right. associated with that. We haven't looked at that. Our rate structure hasn't looked at that as far as what you're talking about, but from a consumer side, some consumers like to see what their hourly water usage is
okay.
so that they can balance that against their bill. So these meters get readings every 15 minutes. It also helps with leaks potentially that your meter can notify you that we've got a leak in your house, those type of things. And that gets to the point where we see from our customer service side, our utility customers come in, and they say, well, I didn't know I've had a leak 30 days ago or 2 weeks ago or 10 days ago, but it looks like on the bill my usage is up. We see it when we do the meter reading once a month. But these new meters in the ground can have that technology to provide better information.
Where does that data go every 15 minutes?
Well, it bubbles up. It stores, from what I recall, it stores in the meter and then bubbles up basically to a website. On a period to upload the information, maybe once an hour, maybe every 15 minutes.
Actually get the information here.
Well, we would see it as well, basically on a screen, basically to say, here's your consumption for today, here's what it was yesterday, here's the peak that's occurring between 2 a.m. and 4 a.m., those type of things. So,
I think we've done the current, the meters are capable of doing that with AMI technology. Mm-hmm. But we're not using that AMI technology right now. But the thought is if we wanted to go towards AMI technology, the meters are ready for that. So we can see that, right?
And I believe other people were using the same meter prior to us getting these meters. So we know
correct.
From them as well.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Greg?
If you do not have any, you have to look at it. Also,
that would be great. And then we'll get into page 10, key operating expenses and capital outlay. 10-minute break? Is that what you're looking for? Or?
Yeah.
Okay.
Would that be okay?
Yeah, 10 minutes? Be great. Thank you.
We are, after our 10-minute break, we're ready to begin again. We're going to begin on page 10, key operating expenses and capital outlay.
Very good. Thank you very much. So the budget reflects targeted adjustments to operating costs and capital outlay to support efficient service delivery. Areas with decreased costs include our capital outlay, repairs and maintenance, traditional debt service, and software and technology. Insurance-related costs 13% increase in property and liability premiums, 86% increase in workers' compensation premiums. Our equipment investments proposed are $75,900 for replacement or procurement of operating equipment. And then a section here on the bond anticipation note, the band we refer to. We have an interest expense of $1,176,000. We have interest earnings on the bond anticipation note of $525,000, the net impact of $651,000. Appreciation funding is $2.7 million. That funds 84% of appreciation funding. I'll just read the last paragraph, and then we can go over any one of those items up above. So in conclusion, the FY26-27 budget exemplifies Sigwassa's commitment to fiscal responsibility, operational excellence, and the long-term stewardship of utility systems our community depends on. By leveraging increased revenues and strategically utilizing available fund balance, the budget supports critical staffing needs, infrastructure improvements, and equipment enhancements without increasing rates for customers. These investments strengthen our capacity to sustain and improve service delivery while proactively preparing for future regulatory and infrastructure challenges. Thank you for your continued leadership and dedication to Sigwassa's mission of providing quality water and sanitary sewer services to our customers in an efficient, sustainable, and environmentally conscious manner. So thank you, committee members. So going back to our key operational expenses and capital outlay at the page, top of page 10, I think that one of the items that whatever questions that you have, but you may want to start with insurance related costs, and Richard can guide us through that as well if you have any questions and want to start there.
86% increase in workers' comp?
Yes. The 13% in property and liability, we're seeing a significant increase in claims against our property and liability. Historically, they were very low, fender bender on a truck, that sort of thing. Now we're seeing some significant increases, and I will say for the benefit of the committee and passing along to the board as they come into this budget process, that the 13% was provided by our insurance provider and our agent prior to two large claims coming on the radar in the last 30 days. So we may, you know, we may be even worse off than 13% when those claims hit. There's three in the pipeline right now. Three of them significantly large.
Due to 85 issues?
No.
Okay.
The workers' comp premium problem, that is unprecedented. Historically, Sigwassa's workers' comp premiums were low. 7 years ago, we had one significant claim, the first one in Sigwassa's history. That one dropped off, it was 6 years ago, because that one dropped off 2 years ago. Of course, they stay on, I think, 3 or 4 years, and then they drop. So we were seeing a decrease in premiums. Now we're seeing a significant increase in workers' comp claims. And so that is affecting our mod rate. But now keep in mind, if you're looking at those two percentages, keep in mind that property and liability premiums are much higher than workers' comp premiums. So 86% increase in workers' comp premium, yes, that's bad. But dollar-wise, it may not be any more dollar-wise than the 13% increase in property and liability, because those are larger, the premiums larger by nature anyway. And I will give you, before we leave that, I will give you some dollars that will help you understand the percentage. So property and liability for fiscal year, for current fiscal year 25-26, we had budgeted originally $154,400. Let's say $154K. This year we're anticipating that to be $175K, or possibly higher once these three claims, they come to realization.
What were those numbers again? Last year?
154,400.
Okay.
175 in the post 26-27. 175,000.
Okay.
Workers' comp, fiscal year 25-26 original was 43,000. But you'll recall that we had budget amendments since then because claims had already, since last year's budget was passed, there were some claims that were in the pipeline at that time that actually occurred. We brought on some new positions that the board approved that weren't in that original budget. I believe 3 or 4 positions were added. So the 43 wouldn't cover it, so we had a budget amendment. This year, that number is in this year. The proposed 26-27 includes 80,000 for workers' comp premiums, thus your 86%. So it's 86% in comparison to last year's original budget, but we've done a VA since the end for last year's original budget on workers' comp.
Okay. So what is occurring to cause the increase to the workers? What is there a certain thing that continues to happen?
I'll defer. Now that I don't do HR, I don't have insight into the workers' comp claims, so I can't speak to that. I can tell you that our agent said the workers' comp claims and the mod rate associated with those claims is dramatically higher. Are they one or two big claims, or are there a lot of little claims? I can't speak to that. Maybe Scott can.
Am I asking too hard of questions right now, or is that something I need to?
No, I think that it would be best, because the HR manager is not here today to answer that, just to take that question back and look at that information and provide it back to the finance committee, which we would do, just trying to keep it very high level. I think reading between the lines, because it's the same thing that I do, it's saying, well, is there something that the employer is not doing as far as a safety item or training or something like that that's potentially causing that issue? That is not the case. I've asked that question already. You know, as I see some of these items coming up, it's very easy to file a workers' comp claim. So things do happen with your employees, and it does happen. And the more employees we get, the chance that that's going to occur. But we'll take a look at that and see if we can kind of categorize that for you in broad terms. But yeah, it's not leading where you might have concerns.
Excellent. Do we also know, is it more of a property damage that we are actually creating, and it is something that we create, or just put in and it may not be our fault?
I'll say it's something we've created, but it's some of these claims that we've had have been a result of other utilities that are in the ground that have been damaged from utility work that we've done.
Gotcha. Yes. Understand that.
Are we contacting 811?
We are, and there's specific things that, I mean, a lot of these lines were put in the 40s. They've had the other utilities that have been putting in the ground right beside them. Some of them have been marked, not marked. Some of them have been over top of things that
don't show up.
Either don't show up or wouldn't normally be there, I guess would be the case.
I understand we do a lot of digging.
We do.
When the city is there on site.
Yeah. When you have something that's right over top of another utility.
Right beside you.
Yeah,
right under you. Right on top of you.
Correct. Yeah. And that's the thing about putting something in the right of way of the road as opposed to a dedicated utility. Right away, you're dealing with a lot of other utilities in the road. If it's a dedicated right of way for your utility, you have the right to not have anything else in that, but it's not as easy to get that.
Understand. Thank you.
Would you like any explanations on the bond anticipation note? And that's related to the I-85 project and the USDA funding. Been having a lot of talk about that recently, or then depreciation funding get on the screen.
So I thought that last year when we did the budget, we took depreciation up to 90. Our goal was 95, but I thought we stayed at 90, but I might be wrong. We might have gone up to, I'm trying to understand why we're back down to 84 again.
That's a good question, and I would like to clarify that bullet point there. So that's correct. When we did the rate model and the last rate increase, which was two fiscal years ago, at that point, our depreciation expense was $2.4 million, I believe. You were funded 95%, which equates to $2,280,000, $2.28 million. Okay. Is what that 95% at that time was funded. Mm-hmm. So if you say we're still, we haven't done a rate increase or a change of funding since then. So 2.28 million in relation to the increased depreciation expense, which is now 2.7 million, represents an 84% funding level. So that's how you arrive at that. You haven't changed your funding level dollar amount wise, but your increase, your expense is going up, which means the amount that 2.28 funds is going to drop. And I will say to that point that, well, why is our depreciation expense gone from 2.4 to 2.7? Well, of course, you spent 1.3 million this year on capital improvement. Mm-hmm. New vehicles, trucks, heavy equipment. That's hitting the books. You got to depreciate that 5, 7, 10 years. I will put one alert out there for you. The minute I-85 comes along, you're talking about an $85 million construction project hitting your depreciation in a 40-year, if you assume a 40-year life. You're talking about a $2 million annual depreciation that's associated solely with that project. So you will see that 2.7 go, in my estimation, to 5 million. At that point, 2.28 of 5 million is, what, 40% maybe. So that percentage will continue to plunge unless you, as depreciation expense increases. I'm sorry?
Because we have more assets.
More assets, but in this case, larger construction assets. Of course, you can buy a whole lot of backhoes and trucks for $85 million worth of pipeline, right? So we've got a lot of them coming online. We've got the 1 million water filter that's going to hit it this year, of course. And so all of these projects, as they come in service, they do hit depreciation expense. Now, that is a non-cash flow expense in the sense that when we get to the ordinance and we talk about, well, now it's showing a fund balance use on the ordinance. Well, that's not truly an outflow of cash. It's just that you're not funding depreciation expense, which is an intangible expense. It's not like your chemicals and your fuel and your light bills that you physically have to pay cash for. It is an unfunded expense.
Okay, Chris, you ready? Mm-hmm. So when I-85 is done, I guess this is a Scott and Chris question.
We'll start with Chris.
How many more people do we have to hire to maintain this new sewer system?
I'll answer that question for you. Okay. I'll answer that question for you. So keep in mind that a lot of the infrastructure that's going in the ground is replacement of existing infrastructure. Okay, it's larger, but you have a Joe P. pump station, small, converted to Joe P. large, basically. So that's, you just kind of switch your maintenance to that. You've got brand new infrastructure in the ground, not 40, 50, 60 year old infrastructure. So the amount of time that you will spend on fixing that is going to be less, right, over time, because of that new equipment. We have two new pump stations going in. East Middleton, as well as Joe Peed, but they are replacements for existing infrastructure. And we do have a new segment of pipeline going underneath Highway I-85 that is new pipe construction. So, and that's going to require maintenance for that as well. But think about it over time, over the next 40 years, we will have to maintain that, those assets, but it's not going to be highly aggressive type of maintenance on those assets. We'll be able to spend more time on the older assets. That's really where you want to spend your time, the older pipes, the older water lines, and bringing those up to today's standards as well.
So initially, we're not going to need to hire a ton more people to cover them.
Not initially. And what will be nice that if this proves out, as we speculated to, that over the next 10, 15, 20 years, as the utility is growing as far as the customer base, you're going to have greater revenues coming in, which will help support and offset these increased costs, enable for us to staff to do more maintenance in certain areas. For example, instead of paying a contractor $200,000 to $300,000 a year to do sewer maintenance, it may be a better capital investment just to have two guys do the sewer maintenance for you and the televising by spending the upfront capital initially and paying that off over time. So those are the kind of things that we'll look at as well as we can resource it. We're very lean on the resourcing side as far as human resources in the organization. It does limit us, but I think in the future we'll have the ability to expand that somewhat as needed for additional maintenance activities.
Okay.
Yeah.
can say if you look at what in Fairmont has a whole lot of broken pipes happening. With them, you don't see any because it's a new one.
For example.
Okay. But that's 20 years old now, so 20 years from now, you're going to start the MRI.
Well, a different composition of pipe, too. I mean, we're putting in fiber-reinforced fiberglass. This new pipe, it's beyond plastic. It's greater than plastic and lifeline, you know, and it's not the old pipe and the clay pipe and those type of things in the ground. So we
look forward to... Does it have a life expectancy?
Pardon me?
Does it have a life expectancy?
A great life, yeah. I think that we estimate 50 years plus.
Well, that's nice.
Yeah. So this is a great investment. Any other questions on that section before we turn to the proposed budget ordinance on page 11?
Why does it not say proposed?
It should. That's my oversight.
The whole presentation is proposed. So it's
okay.
Proposed.
I'm just, usually it's always says proposed. I'm looking at it, I'm like, it doesn't say proposed.
Okay, top of page 11. So this is our budget ordinance. So, Richard, you want to walk us through? We've already had a lot of conversation, but if you want to just get the highlights of our revenue and expenditure section,
sure. So, the fiscal year 26-27 proposed budget ordinance includes, as we talked about earlier in the executive summary, the water and sewer revenues. The water revenue is increased $150,000. Revenue is increasing $200,000, and there's $75,900 for capital outlay in the ordinance. You'll see that the total revenues go from are $17.8 million. If you'll recall, when we were looking at the previous ordinance, I believe it's 18.8, so it's down about $1 million, as Scott indicated at the beginning. You'll see in the expenditures, we won't go through every line item. Most of the departments are pretty much consistent with prior years. You will see the two new departments for finance and public information offices that we discussed earlier, pulling those amounts out of the admin department. So if you were to compare the admin last year to the admin this year, it's going to be lower because we pull now out those associated costs. And the expenses, of course, are balanced at $17.8 million. Talking about the fund balance transfer line, you'll see that it shows a transfer of fund balance or a use of fund balance in this case of $342,511. Now, what is that? As we talked about a few minutes ago, there's $420,000 unfunded depreciation. We talked about a minute ago, you've got a $2.7 million budgeted expense for depreciation expense. We're only funding $2,280,000 of that based on prior approval from the board. That leaves a deficit of $420,000 in depreciation expense you're not funding. And that is netted against, if you will, for lack of a better term, of course, we're in the cross fund, we're not a business, we don't have a net income, but revenues over expenses in this proposed budget are $77,489. So you've got, for ease of discussion, a net profit of $77,489, netted against that $420,000. Unfunded. And so that's a net of $342,511. To Scott's point earlier, of course, we pulled the bond anticipation note, debt, and associated interest income out of this ordinance so it wouldn't skew the operating numbers. That will be, if the funding allows, that will be funded by CIP fund balance. A budget amendment will be brought to you in the first meeting in July. To put that on the books without skewing the original ordinance, just as we do any of capital projects, we bring you a budget amendment to roll those projects forward year to year since we don't have a capital projects fund.
So is this where I would need to bring up again disconnect late fees, or do you want me to wait until D?
Well, if we can go wait until D, that would be fine as well. We've got it noted here.
Okay.
Yep. All right. Page 12. Did you cover all of page 12?
I did. The verbiage at the bottom, of course, is just the same as last year. The executive director's authorization to move up to $10,000 within a department, excluding any pay and benefits accounts. That hasn't changed. So we're looking at revenues of $17,886,011 and expenditures of the same.
Okay.
which brings your balanced budget ordinance.
And that's a decrease over our current fiscal year budget. So last year we were, for our current fiscal year, we're at $18,885,826. And our proposed 26-27 is $17,886,11. So about a negative 5.3% difference or decrease year over year. We had any questions on the proposed budget ordinance?
So, we have administration human resources, and now we have administration finance human resources. So, and PIO. So, I'm assuming that finance and PIO were included in the administration.
That's correct.
Last year?
That's correct.
Okay. All right. So this is no rate increase, no fund balance transfer, as it is right now.
No fund balance transfer, true fund balance transfer. When I say true, meaning cash outflow.
Right.
That is correct. So you've got a good budget ordinance. And I will say, as the treasurer, that I think this is a very comfortable budget ordinance. I think we've done a great job internally of managing the budget, keeping
this
budget
is the
budget in line.
The first time I ever saw it go down.
With the, well, now keep in mind when we talk about going down a million, that's because last year we had $1.3 million in capital outlay that was, we knew was a one-time expense. So operating expenses are up slightly, but it's being offset by the fact that we did not have capital outlay this year. But in today's inflationary rates, to keep a budget even close to being prior years, to your point, is a good thing. And we
have been hardly less budget amendments this coming year?
I won't promise you, because things are changing faster than I can keep up, but I will tell you that I feel a lot more confident that we shouldn't. With any knowns. Now let me go ahead and put my legal disclaimer.
The emergency that comes up.
I'll give you a prime example right now. We looked, Chris and I looked very closely at the gas expense this year, which has been budgeted for 3 years now, somewhat high from, of course, prior to like 3 or 4 years ago. And we said, well, 3 year trend is down. Let's reduce those gas expenses. So we worked 2 weeks ago, we assembled a budget with lower gas prices. Now what's happening today? Should that continue in the next fiscal year? Of course, one thing that people don't realize is that our chemical prices are highly contingent on petrol prices.
Mm-hmm.
So if gas prices were to be next year, you're going to have a budget amendment for gas for the vehicles, but you're also probably going to have a chemical budget amendment. Let's hope that does not come true. But that's a prime example of things that we can't foresee. But with the knowns, I feel very confident that we're in a good place not to have budget amendments. And no, I won't put that in writing.
You're recording. This isn't in writing.
Yeah, it's there. So anything further on that section before we move on? If not, we'll move on to item 9C, the top of page 13, our proposed repairs and maintenance and capital outlay for the upcoming fiscal year. So you'll see a schedule on the page, two budget areas, account 5100 and account 5200. We deal with these expenses. Your 5100 account is expenses less than $5,000, correct?
That's correct.
And the account 5200 are expenses related that are greater than $5,000 for capital outlay. So you can see on the page here, we have some items in engineering, our billing collections area, our waterline maintenance area, and wastewater treatment plant area. So we'll be happy to entertain any questions or comments the committee has regarding that table.
Video surveillance system, do we not have one down there? Are we replacing an old one or down at the wastewater treatment plant? For $20,000, are we replacing or putting one in?
New.
New, that's what I thought.
Yep.
I didn't think there was one.
Yeah, and I'd like to speak to that for just a moment because this is something
we absolutely need it.
We're going to be doing this around the entire utility. One of the things that prevented us from taking this move, especially at the wastewater treatment plant, was the fact that our communications
at that facility were extremely weak because it sits in a bowl. So over the last year or so, I think when we did the upgrade to fiber technologies with Spectrum, we have a dedicated fiber line now that runs down all the way to that facility to provide us with the capabilities to do enhanced video surveillance on the site and also get that information up and out of there for our review at the same time. So we're starting at the wastewater treatment plant with that upgrade of that system to the gates and video presence, and we'll then continue to do that as we move forward with the other facilities.
Will it be monitored by supervisor on duty?
It's the technology. I'm not sure if you've looked at video surveillance technology recently, but it's AI enhanced and notifications and intruder alerts. And I think there's options for us also to bring on a service for monitoring at the same time. Yeah. But the newer systems are quite impressive. But again, it was the bandwidth. We just didn't have the bandwidth capability to do anything like that on that site. So we've achieved that, which is great.
Fiber.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. No, I remember when I came on, there was no signal down there when I took my tour.
And I will point out one thing before you continue, and Ruben just pointed out to me, there is an error in the 7120 that $1,500 should actually be in the 5100 column, and I will correct that before it goes to public.
Mm-hmm.
Because that is below 5,000, so it should really be assigned to line 5100. 5100 being the GL department line.
Quick question about the video surveillance. Does that come with an app so that you can look at it on your phone?
I'm sure it does. Yeah. So that once it wakes up or gets an alert, like an intruder alert or something like that, not only would your operators on site have it, but it comports the supervisors as well. Let us know what's going on.
Chris just said thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Chris never gets to slip again.
We both
a rabbit ran by, a deer ran by.
We both get a lot of things 24/7 on our phones. So, all right. Anything else on that section?
Okay.
All right. The next page, page 14, you've got the proposed budget request and maintenance, R&M. This is the budget account of a 3520 account. We have wastewater treatment plant area. And also 8,000 pump and lift stations and tanks. Chris, is there anything that you want to highlight on the wastewater treatment plant?
I'll specifically highlight the facility roof replacements. Some of these buildings are very old and they're in need of repair for the roof. And then we have two large generators at the wastewater treatment plant, one of which needs some extensive repairs to it. So you see that here.
And that's not covered by the preventative maintenance generator thing we just did at our last meeting.
It's a significant expense, and so based on that, we wanted to put it in this year's budget.
Based on the preventative maintenance inspections that we do, it gleaned from the inspections that these repairs were necessary, and hence that's why you see this a capital expense now. That's how that program works. That's a good example of this is what's wrong. Let's get this replaced. And do you recall from your tour the size of these?
Yes.
Generate the big yellow boxes down there. They almost look there like a separate building.
Like a room, like
yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
And then we just have some pump station rehabilitation listed here for two pump stations we want to work on. So
the Sotheby's pump station rehab, is that because we're not replacing the pump station with the brands that was originally planned?
Right.
So we have to do the rehab because their proposal didn't work.
Correct.
Okay.
All right.
Chris, did you, how did y'all come up with $30,800 for the roof replacement?
So we got a contractor to give us a quote on, buildings, and we took that quote and added a 10% contingency to it.
All right, moving on. 9B, proposed budget review of schedule of rates and fees and charges. Okay, so again, I would have pulled up that you have a copy of the entire catalog in front of you here. And this has an effective date of July 1st, 2026. It aligns with our fiscal year. We include this document as part of the approved budget. So when you actually approve the operating budget for the next fiscal year, It includes a recommendation or part of the motion to also accept the current schedule of rates and fees and charges aligned with the fiscal year. So we've gone through this schedule this year. We don't have any substantial changes to it. If we did, we would note those this morning at this meeting. So, but again, it creates a nice manual of all the charges that we have here. You can see from the table of contents listed on page 2, the different breakdowns that we have related to this. So this will be, if there's any changes today coming out of this, and of course this meeting, and of course we will update this and have this prepared for the upcoming meetings as well. I change the color every year just because we use these documents a lot, and we don't want us referring to the 24-25 rates or 23. So we've gone, I think the last couple of years we're in a citrus color. I think that right last year was green, this year is orange-ish. So what we have here, I'll just point out to you as well, that if you want to follow up on discussion from previous, earlier in the meeting, about any related fees, you would want to look at Section 4, Schedule of Service Charges and Fees. And my catalog says, my book says page 15, Section 4.9. So we can start off with page 12, late payment fees. If you want to take a look at that, it's up to the committee how you want to drive this.
So there's three items that I've written down so far that we're not funding. And that is a building for Sagwassa. That is, we're not funding full depreciation for AIM or the meters. Is that correct?
That is correct.
So our goal as the finance committee, is to get to 100% of depreciation and fund the other items that we're not funding. The goal also with the new meters is to bring on board an AIM type service. And Sagwassa has also said within the next 10 years, they'll need a new building. And we're not putting any money back to any of those items. We're actually losing money on depreciation. So my thoughts were, instead of hitting the ratepayers, it needs to go more towards the people that are not doing what they're supposed to be doing. And that's a bad way to say it, but that's the best way I can put it.
One of the items you talked about, you need more space, maybe mm-hmm. another location. I know you have the possibility of still renting or leasing here at your same location. But also there's the, I think you mentioned it too, I don't know what the options may be for the Butner Elementary School. I think you favor more of the second building behind the first.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if you consider, since it's not real nearby in the future, I didn't know if you consider that as an option. And I don't know if you've had an opportunity to look at this fence of what you might do to get it ready. I know it's the better of a two buildings.
Yes, so let me just speak to that, since that was one of the items that was just put on the table for discussion here by Commissioner McLean. We recognize that the utility, as it's growing, and as the town of Butner is growing at the same time, administrative staff, we share the same building here. Obviously, we lease it from the town of Butner. And I think our first lease agreement is it 20 years?
It's 20 years.
20 years. So just going from memory, our lease, first 20-year lease expires in 2030, I believe. And then there's opportunities for two subsequent 10-year leases beyond that. So just to understand the framework here. So again, we share half of the building on the other side of the hallway here. Both entities are stretching out. We share common rooms here, which has worked out very well. Thank you to the town of Butner. So knowing that we are growing as a utility and looking for the next 20 or 30 years, we looked at a project for facility needs for the organization absent the water plant. The reason I say absent the water plant is because the water plant is its own special project, especially with the PFAS project that we're doing and knowing that there's a lot that has to be done on that campus. So we kind of ignored the water plant at this point, but we looked at the utility section, the wastewater section, and the admin. And the board approved for administration a cost of $50,000, $75,000, less than $100,000. I seem to recall it's $50,000, but I can fine-tune that. A study to analyze what we need. So it was a facility needs study because I couldn't tell you today if I didn't do that study what I needed. And that would be the question, what do you need, where are you going to go? So the board approved that last year. We completed the study. I received the results, I think, December, January of this year. And we had we documented what Sidwasa's space needs are for the next 25 years. It was a great exercise because what we did is we brought everybody into a room over time in the conference room, and we basically said, okay, here's our current structure. I want you to list all the things that we have now, all the things that we're not doing, and all the things that you think that we would need to do if we doubled in size. And the reason I said doubled in size was over the next 20 or 30 years, if we meet that growth that possibly the I-85 project may bring us over the next 20 years, we will double our customer base, and that has a demand on the services that we will have to provide. So on and so forth. So we went through that exercise, which was a great exercise. It's quite a challenge, as it would be for this committee to say, okay, tell us what you think we're going to be doing or how we're going to look 30 years from now. But we actually went through a structured exercise, and we actually designed charts and looked at staffing. We looked at new programs. We looked at demands to do maybe some of the maintenance in-house for vehicle maintenance versus sending out to contractually, so on and so forth. So where am I going with this? So We said the best way for us to determine what our footprint would be in the future is to understand where we would be in the future and then back that down in 5-year increments to where we are today and say, okay, now I understand that if we're going to grow to this, ultimately we would need this type of square footage. So we understand that now. So once we understood the square footage, we went through a design process with an engineer and an architect and said, how would you put us together on a campus if we were to buy 100 acres someplace or have 100 acres available to us and we could put utilities and administration building, those so on and so forth. So we went through that exercise to understand how we would establish those facilities in storage and garages. And then as the project was just about ready to wrap up, we had an opportunity based on the county's request to go look at the school system across the street. Those buildings, the Butner STEM Elementary School, that is no longer occupied with school students. And part of the proposal of professional program we were doing included several site study analysis or projections. So we said, let's use this investment and take it across the street and look at that facility. So we actually did tours of the facilities, got the plans for the facilities, and then we provided that to the architect. The architect came back and said, here's what we can do with that existing building. Here are the costs for that. Here's what you could do on that campus. Here's the cost for the utilities. And here's some things that you would need to do with the other facilities. So we have that package. So somebody asked, well, why has the board not seen that package yet? Well, the board hasn't seen that package yet because we're still working on I-5, the budget, and PFAS, which unfortunately have replaced anything that we want to do currently right now as far as a priority, but it's in the top 5 priorities of things that we're working on. And we will schedule a time to come back and have a deeper dive with the finance committee. I think that would be an appropriate place to start, along with our strategic plan update, which is something we need to get back to this year. Based on all of that, we have a great plan in terms of what the needs would be. It's very costly, but any time that you can leverage existing space would be great. Now, the question is that the right location? Well, it's a great location for the admin and finance team because we can just walk across the street and still use the boardroom for board meetings. You know, it's not that long of a drive. It's very convenient to utilize in this facility. In terms of utilities, Well, I can't say it's the best location for the utility team because our service area is going to be growing more towards Highway 56 and East Line and Creedmoor. Our utilities team is located at the wastewater treatment plant presently. So it's a long drive to get all the way out to Creedmoor and back again. So we're thinking maybe something more central to that area, maybe a commercial zone or industrial may be better for a utilities team and warehouse and trucks and those type of things. So long story short, we have a great vision of what we need to do and where we're growing in the future. We just haven't quite figured out how all these pieces come together, and we haven't put a plan together yet, to your point, Commissioner, to say if our goal was to do this by X year, what would we do, how would we move there, and how could we afford to do that? That has yet, the capital improvement plan has yet to be laid out for that based on those expenses. The report was very timely, provides a lot of great information. It would give us the flexibility that if the board thought it was recommended that we do look at leasing something across the street for admin, at least we have that information. That would be a good first step. And I think this whole project needs to be looked at as multiple steps in order to get us there over time. Long answer, but that's that point on that. So we'll have additional discussion on that, but that's an unfunded project at this point. But it's something that we're going to have to circle and put on our books for discussion and also planning in long-term CIP. Any questions on that?
Yeah, I thought I heard you say leasing for admin. In other words, not interested in buying.
There's many options.
Okay.
There's many options for that. It would be, right now, I believe the county it's under their domain, the facility
right
across the street. So, we would have those discussions. When I say leasing, there may be an option that across the street, maybe it's a purchase, maybe it's just a move in, maybe it's a long-term lease. I don't know what the county would want.
Okay.
They might want a 100-year lease or something like that for a dollar. I'm not sure. And then we maintain the building. There may be existing commercial structures out there that would be more advantageous to lease for utility in, or we would do our cost analysis and say, no, we're no further ahead after 20 years. It's a better capital expense up front just to build a facility on a campus and know that you could expand your structures over time to meet your demands, those type of things. So that exercise has yet to be gone through with any seriousness. It's basically just high level right now as far as the data. Administration, executive level, looking at that, but we have completed that.
How much land do you have for the wastewater treatment plant?
Actual acres. Chris will take a look at that. So, what are your thoughts? Just want to know what it is or trying to think about how to use some of that campus for?
Yes. Uh-huh.
So we've looked at that many times. So one of the things that you'll be seeing, we just completed our 30% plan review with CDM Smith for PFAS construction. And the proposed building for the PFAS will occupy the right side of the driveway when you pull into the facility itself. There's a large open field to your right. So that's going to, the large building is going to occupy that space. The rest of the campus, as it sits, we're reserving for future upgraded infrastructure to move to those open fields, if you will. So as you need to build new chlorine contact chambers or clear wells, you've got to keep the existing facility producing water while you're constructing. So you have to have a place to put that infrastructure. So when you build it over time, you build something new, you can demolish the other section and eventually move things around. But the way we've looked at that campus right now, it's a good campus for our future water infrastructure for the water plant. It's a little bit strained in terms of trying to think that we could put an administration building there or build out the utilities building on that site. It's not impossible. We just haven't looked at that in terms of just trying to focus on that. I will let you know that I've had some conversations with the Butner Town Manager about this facility plan and how close we are to the downtown and the parks and things like that, and asked if there's opportunities for us at Wasa to look at some Butner-owned property around that could serve our needs as well. We just haven't reached out to the city of Creedmoor yet or STEM, but we'll be doing the same thing, going through the same exercises to see if there's opportunities that we can leverage some existing property should you be owning that property.
Which facility did you ask about?
Water treatment plant.
Water treatment plant, about 10 and a half acres.
Okay.
Waste water treatment plant is 59 acres, all of which require setbacks and potential wetlands and as well as non-permeable percentage of surface, you know, for false lake pools.
Okay. Like you said, you mentioned a lot of grades that you might want to part of to be in Fremont to help with centralizing travel.
Mm-hmm.
That makes sense too. Mm-hmm. Okay, thank you very much.
Sure.
So, projects and studies in this budget is the lowest I've seen it ever.
Mm-hmm.
Usually it's 50,000 or somewhere around that. Last year it was 23,500. Now it's down to 3,500. We got nothing planned in the works? I mean, it's the lowest. I'm 3,500 this year on my books. Really low.
That's a good cut. You're paying attention to that.
Of course I
do. That was a test. Now, I'm glad you brought that up, though, seriously, because what used to be in that department, 20,000 of that was a discretionary executive director progress, so that if he came up with a $5,000 small project, he could come and use that money. That was, now that we're splitting out admin and moving out finance and PIO to make that truly an admin Scott Chris budget, we decided to move that line out of projects and put it in admin, so it would be more it would be easily administrated by them as part of professional services.
So it
just moved to a different place, a more appropriate place. The 3,500 is remaining. That's the lead and copper ongoing annual review mailings. Mm-hmm. That's what that's for. So that's why that dropped from 50 to 23 to now 3,500. The 20 got moved to that.
So this architect that you just were talking about, where did that money come out of the projects and studies part of the budget? Where did that?
I have to go back and look at the purchase order on that, but I think that just came out of CIP. I think that was in our CIP.
And you talk about expanding the Welcome Center with the fact that we are coming to the end of this lease.
Mm-hmm.
Do you believe that the town of Buckingham will allow you to expand the Welcome Center before we move out?
I think that two things. I think that the town of Butner would say, go ahead and expand all that you want within your internal building structure.
Right.
So Richard would lose his office, and so would Ruben, for example, so that we have a larger lobby.
Ruben leaned forward and looked like, where do I know?
Put him in the custom.
So you go ahead and do what you want within your existing square footage, I believe is how it would be. I don't think they're going to allow us to add new drive-up lane to a window or to add on to the building. That's not to say that they wouldn't.
Right.
But those would be things that we would want to consider as well. So in that example, if we were not going to expand the building, we would say at some point, okay, Richard, Ruben, you are going to lose your office square footage up front. And in order to keep you in the same building, now we're going to lose engineering and somebody else in the building. We're going to have to go put them in a retail space and get them off-site so that we can do more on-site. So you end up potentially, when you say leasing, okay, who's got 2,500 square feet available next to Food Lion, for example, like the county, that we can put engineering and field services in? So now you start to disperse like that. One of the things that we did look at with the school facility, I think we call it building number 3 across the way, is the way the building is situated and the way the side street is. When we talked to the architect, we said we would like to put customer service at the front of the building, which I think is that to the east side. That what that is?
The
north or east side.
North side.
And we would like a driveway to come off of the street. We would like to have a drive-through access for our customers right up against the building. And so our customer service would be up front at the front of the building. Our finance team would be up front. We would have more of a department up front and customer service at the front of the building. And the space is large enough. For example, we are, what's our square footage here that we occupy? It's 3,000 feet. It's not that large. We looked at our needs. Our future needs are 10,000 square feet of space for admin, and that building is just about 9,500 square feet of admin. So it works.
But that would be the idea that, you know, instead of trying to do something within the walls here, look at, okay, so it's really your first move. If you were to acquire the building, for example, at a low lease cost, or if it was just given to us, for example, there's an expense to that as far as maintenance and operations. But one of the first things that you would do is you would plan for, okay, who's going to leave first? You know, who's going to get over to that building and occupy it? And if we were going to renovate it for customer service and finance, that would be a project in the building. And it would, let's just say it takes a year. And then come, you know, October 1st, we say, this weekend or this week, we're going to move the finance department and customer service out of here over to the new facility and operate from there. So eventually over time, you want to close out your operation here as you're building up over there. And that's kind of the beauty of having an existing building. You work within that frame over a period of time as you're moving people around.
Those walls are all city walking at school, aren't they?
Yeah, it's a great building. We have all the structural information, both the roof and walls and the electrical.
The moving walls is more difficult than a sheetrock wall. That's the point.
Well, there's a lot of curtain walls. There's a lot of curtain walls in there, just non-load bearing, you know, so it's got a great structure. So it's very beautiful. But we did in our analysis, and I apologize for not having a study in front of you right now to refer to, but we did a breakdown for each department, their square foot needs and their costs, so that we could think about potentially if we had a 10-year plan or a 5-year plan to exit this building, how would we do it? What would the cost be? How do we put money towards it, to your point? If we can do that on top of everything else that we're doing, and I'm sure the finance director is saying, oh, great, one more project for us to do, right? How are you going to pay for that, right? Is that always the question?
That's where I'm coming. Yeah, so. You know what I'm thinking? Wheels are turning. There's no more money to pay for it.
Where's that money?
You know where that money's coming from. What did you start the meeting? No rate increase?
Mm-hmm.
So, Kenneth, you mentioned something about a possible rate increase for late payments. Are you
late and disconnect?
Is that still a suggestion?
That is a suggestion. I have $15 late fee and $100 disconnect fee. So that would take it from 10 to 15 and from 75 to 100. And I believe that funding would need to go to one of those three items or split them up between those three items, being the AIM, the building / facility, and depreciation.
How much does AIM cost?
AMI.
AMI, I'm sorry.
AMI, it really depends, but I'd have to look at them because it's gone up over time, but I would say an estimate for the number of meters that we have is probably in the $7 to $10 million range. I will preface that with give you the information that not even the larger utilities around us, a lot of them still do not use AMI technology. So it's definitely a good luxury to have. Necessity, no, you have to outweigh. That's the way your options are.
Well, I will say I experienced, I'm not saying what kind of technology they have, but it sounds like that Wilmington has it because I went down there. I had a house that I was preparing. And when I got, before I even got there, she called and told me the water bill is really high in the usage. And then she told me right away, and I was, you know, I thought that was curious that she could do that. So I thought that was a nice benefit.
It definitely has great benefits to it, not only for the customer side, but also for the utility, because the more information, the better, especially if it's, you know, right here in front of your face. But again, it's very costly too.
Yeah.
We will, with where we have foundationally with our meters and our structure in place, as we grow over the next 5 and 10 years, and it's going to be geographic expansion as well throughout all of our communities, there's opportunities to, instead of investing in resources to go out and read those meters, because that's travel time now to the outer areas to gather that information, we'll look at those costs. But we may want to look at doing some pilot projects with AMI first, not just jump in with both feet, but say, let's select an area. And we've thought about that with some of the growth in the housing. For example, the Meritage Homes subdivision and Mangum Farms out in the Butner Stem area. That area is potentially growing tremendously here in the next several years. That may be a great place to test with some AMI receivers. This is information that goes kind of up in the air or on your pump stations, and it basically collects all the signals from all the meters and reports it back to our office here. It's going to be worthwhile to do a pilot project, and that would be as new infrastructure, new buildings are being put in or subdivisions, those are things too that we can kind of tack on and
that's
put as part of that infrastructure as well. And say, well, this is a requirement now, not just the auto flusher, but a receiver you need to pay for and put in your subdivision as well, just to collect that data for us so that we can balance that technology with our actual manual reading that's going on or people driving around. But there will be costs to maintaining that too. But I think it's worthwhile to get into studying that. Let's get 85 finished. Let's get the PFAS finished. Let's talk about the facility needs and any other capital that we have. And we can kind of filter that into a capital project over time as well.
Talking about PFAS, I don't
want to
change too much direction,
but
as far as budget, is there any monies we need for PFAS next year?
Well, you'll need all of it. All of it is
$26 million.
We need all the money.
I didn't see that in the budget. It's like just, no rate increase.
No rate increase.
It's just what proportion. So this,
did you see it?
So this, and we touched on this at the last Finance Committee meeting as well. We will update the Finance Committee and the Board with a letter of intent to fund from the state on that $10.1 million once we understand how that comes in, which is good. We've had other grants, as the Finance Committee is aware. We've got an engineering firm, $3.2 million on the contract right now for the design. We just eclipsed 30%. We're going towards 60% next view. This project will be out for bid, I think, this time next year. So in the last committee meeting, you talked about authorizing us to move forward with applying for USDA for them as well. So suffice to say, you're not going to see a lot of that projection built into and financing this budget, but we are working on basically, we kind of look at this one as, let's get this one finished right now, this fiscal year, so we can operate. But in the meantime, in the background, we are now really focusing on PFAS and how this comes together. Because we'll get a better picture on loans and grants and out of pocket, because the question will be, well, how much money is going to come out of fund balance basically to offset these costs? Or is it going to be, I'll just say, 100% financing through USDA? That might be a decision. That package is coming through, and if there's going to be money out of pocket for Seguasa, or taking money out of other areas to fund this, we need to know how that looks on our rates moving forward, right?
That's correct.
So
this is going to slow down our application for USDA loan, since we know there's money possibly coming out of the $26 million. Why would we apply for a USDA loan for $26 million if we know that we don't need all $26 million?
Well, if the cost goes up to $30 million.
Except we only applied for $21,858,000 to the state of North Carolina.
And that was because that was
trying to understand why.
That was a carryover application from 2023. So that was the third time we applied for funding. And before CDM Smith was under contract this last fall to do the PFAS engineering, their engineering analysis application back in 23 was for that $21 million. So we took that application, and that application sits there at DEQ during every funding cycle if you ask it to, and that's what they fund for us. I brought that up to our...
They wouldn't update it? Our CDM Smith wouldn't update that number?
I didn't pay them to update that at the last submittal, but I did talk to them about that so that they can get that dollar amount up. Because I carried that question to them and said, you know, that's great, but I thought you just told me it was $26 million. Why was it only 21? Well, the application just carried through. It just stays there. But we are updating the application as well as we speak, and also for the fall with a better cost. So
by the time it's built, it will be $30 million.
Well, we don't want it to be, but we did 30% review this week, and I think we were at $27 million, which is great now that we're actually engineering it. This is where you can start to squash some of those costs to get it even lower.
So we could say no rate increase right now.
There is no rate increase in this budget. That is correct. And until we put together a financial package and how this all comes together, and the Finance Committee and the Board decide how they want to fund the PFAS, you're going to have that option of cash funding, a portion. Is it cash? Is it rates? Is it rate increase? Is it all loan? How is that? How does that work out? That's coming towards you for this discussion a year from now, if not sooner. Probably December, January, well before the budget, before we get to these meetings, would you say?
So we were thinking
this fall. Isn't that what we talked about recently? We said by the time all this comes together and we have our application started and some of this funding comes through, we see, I think it was a September, October time frame to get back to the community and say, here's what we know. This is where we're headed with this.
We won't get a letter of intent until the governor signs the budget. Is that right?
Well, I think the...
There's got to be a budget approval before any money's distributed.
I think my communication to the board, I said, within 60 days.
I believe what I heard, he carried it over from the last budget.
Which he didn't say.
That's just what I heard, that yeah. It just carries over. It can keep going. Cause
right.
So.
Okay.
I just will elaborate on that one little bit. I don't think whatever direction comes with PFAS would affect this operating budget. I think it would sit outside of this operating budget. And once we know those numbers in September, we would be coming and saying, okay, now here's the path we're on instead of the Finance Committee's path. And I think the earliest you'd see any debt service related to that would be another year away, correct?
That's good.
If not two.
So, how do y'all feel on the $15 late and $100 disconnect fee?
I disagree because I feel like the people that are late or disconnect, they have trouble managing their checking account or their budget. No, I feel like
we
can't afford it.
We can reward them for that?
I think we should educate them.
I believe we did educate them.
By
raising rates. How do you stop somebody from speaking?
I think this is different. This is different.
Do customers have the opportunity to call CWASP and say, can you change my payment date?
No.
No. It's all flat.
And let me, that's a very good point.
Because I know credit card companies can do it.
Let me tell you why we cannot. That's a very good point that the public that may listen to this later would need to know. Because most places can. You can do that with your credit card, most utilities. With CWASP, let me explain why we're 60 days out. Some of you have heard this before, some not. So when you have a city-run system, let's say the city of Creedmoor had your system prior to 2015, and Ruben, you can speak to this, but you send out your bills, let's say, around the last day of the month. Well, you may have them due on the 15th of the following month, or you get a late fee. Then you can disconnect the 20th, a few days later if you want to. So you only have one bill outstanding before the next bill comes out. With Water and Sewer Authority, general statute says that you can set your late fee day, but your disconnection date, non-payment date, must be at least 30 days from the late fee date. So that's why that's pushed out there. So yes, we could change our late fee date, but if we would change late fee date for any one person, then we would have to start managing that group of people for a different disconnect date. Now you've got disconnects occurring all kinds of days, so you have to have a standard date.
Yeah.
Now you can change it from the 5th to the 10th, but that simply means the next month, now we have to push cutoffs from the 12th to maybe the 20th, and now you're entering a third deal that you're going to have, and it gets more and more complicated. So the reason the dates were chosen as they are years ago was simply because you're trying to avoid meter reading cycles where you're trying to cut off in the middle of meter reading cycles, and you're trying to maintain that. When you push one, it pushes the other.
Mm-hmm.
So that's why there's a delicate if there. But no, we do not have the ability to do that. I don't know if you can legally do that, but even if you could, it would be an administrative nightmare because now you would have to administer all those, not only payment dates, but you'd have to do disconnect dates based on those payment dates individually, one by one.
But I think the important thing that you just highlighted is the length of time that the customer has to pay before they are disconnected. Right. Yeah. So they, and if I'm hearing you correctly, time-wise, they have 60 days before we disconnect them.
That's correct.
So, you know, they may get that late charge 1 month, but they also have the ability to pay it before they actually get the large disconnect fee of $75 or $100.
So the late payment is 1.5% with a minimum of $10. So all we're changing is the minimum. If their bill is higher than the minimum for 1.5%, they would have to pay the higher rate anyway. See, somebody's got a bill that's $200, this minimum of $10, they'd have to pay $20 on that. 1.5 times 200.
No, it's either or. So if you've got a $200 bill, then $15 would apply.
Right. $15 would apply anyway. The minimum.
The one,
so I'm thinking the $15 is reasonable.
The 1.5% typically applies to commercial institutional customers.
Yeah.
Because there's usually 1.5% of their bill is
so
much larger.
If somebody is 2 months behind and say their bill, and I've had emails where somebody's bill was $400 or something like that. Do we apply the late fee twice to the one bill that's late and then the second one, or just once to grand total?
Once.
Okay.
Isn't that correct? Once.
You apply the late fee once.
To one bill.
I'm just trying to think between, I'm trying to get my straight between Harris and Tyler, because I think they handle the late fee. I want to say that the late fee is charged on the balance.
It is?
I think so.
Yeah,
the first bill and then you do the second bill and then you add them together, right?
We'll have to get back to you on that. The old software applied at once.
Okay.
So you only got, on any particular bill, even if it went into a, past the second late fee day, you only got a late fee assessed once. To
any bill. Total.
That's correct. The next fee that could be assessed to that same bill would be a non-payment.
Okay, so that we wouldn't be assessing the late fee on a late fee.
That's correct.
Okay.
You can get disconnected.
Yeah.
If you get to pay two late fees, let's say you're a repetitive late fee person and you don't pay enough, then you could get disconnected because your late fees have now accumulated past a certain balance. Mm-hmm. But we'll check on that and get back to the committee.
Do y'all reach out to people when they are late?
No. Here's what we do for late fees. They have the ability to set up alerts, but typically when your second bill comes out, we don't send notifications. We never send notifications for late. We used to send notifications back in the old postcard days, if you ever remember those, if you're old enough. We did send notifications back then for when you were approaching cutoffs back then. It was called cutoffs. Most places have discontinued that practice. We looked at using Smart Notice, which is similar to Code Red that you're probably familiar with, which is cities and counties. We tried that system before you came on board, or right before. Mm-hmm. Right about the time Scott came on board, we said, let's do a weather alert, sort of Code Red alert, for and see how well those are received. We did that pilot test for about 4 months, and we scrapped it. And I'll tell you why we scrapped it. We got some very, very ugly phone calls, similar to people getting spam calls from our customers saying, don't ever call me again, take my number out of your system, I know when my bill is due. So we got some very ugly results. We wanted to see, just like we talk about with fees, what's the trend? What's the cause and effect? Is it a benefit to our customer base? We did see that it improved our non-payments at that point. Our cutoffs dropped below 100, to Scott's point earlier, for the first time. Within 4 months, it was back to where it was. So it had a limited effect, just like raising the fee for 3 months had a limited effect, and we saw a decline, and then it ticked back up, and it was the same group of people, basically, the same number of cutoffs. We saw the same thing with the Smart. It was called Smart Notice. It was a partner, smaller project, a product related to Code Red. So we haven't since. Now, how do they know they've got a late bill? It's after the fact when they get a subsequent bill. They can also go into their online portal, I believe, now, and they have check boxes that, you know, we keep talking about. I wish they would use some of the new features in the new software that we've brought it forward for. There's a lot of notifications within the software. They have notifications on the back of their bill. Of course, you can set a late, you can set a repetitive on your phone now, but every month on the 5th, my bill is due. So there's a lot of mechanisms out there. I don't know how many of the customers utilize them, but to answer your question, no, we do not do anything.
Is there a way to send an email?
I believe the portal, and I'm not that familiar with the portal, but I believe the portal allows them to choose either an email notification or a text notification whenever a bill is either entered in late fee or disconnect status, okay. I believe.
That's the customer's choice.
Correct. Right?
Yeah.
Right.
The other, one of the other downfalls is that customers would not keep their information updated in our database. So we would get a lot of return fails on phone numbers trying to put out an alert on a text message, or where we get failures on cannot deliver email because the customers aren't keeping that information updated. Even though we ask that question, you know, to keep it updated, we had a lot of those failure points at the same time, unfortunately.
So that's us trying to reach out to me.
That's correct.
Sorry, back to what you just wrote about education. It says educate people on late fees by clearly outlining policies and contracts, setting up automated reminders before due dates, and maintaining constant enforcement. Transparent communication about why behind the fee helps client understand it is a policy, not just a penalty.
And I will say that part of our goal, there's a lot of enhancements we talked about earlier at the transition to the new software and some of the challenges we've had in the last year. When bringing a customer service position full time on board, there's a lot of second phase enhancements in the software that we wanted to get to that are more customer friendly, customer service related. And we're just trying to get through making sure the foundations of the software, making sure the bills go out, making sure collections are working. We've struggled with that so much with software glitches this year that we haven't had a chance to get to those next phase improvements, enhancements. So there's a lot more that the software will do that we would like to get in place that we haven't. But one of those is they do offer where we can broadcast notifications, to your point, for both late fee days and cutoff days. So that the capability is there. Now, there is a cost associated with that. Again, you're incurring cost to swap for those broadcasts in some instances. Not an email. Emails are free, but if you send out text notifications, software can't.
I would strictly do emails because most people give their emails out. Most people give their emails out to let them know. And if they don't want to give an email or they change their email, that's kind of on them. That's not on Sublime.
Correct.
Well, I also receive emails, not from Sublime, but from my credit cards. I have two of them. And I appreciate the reminder just because, like I say, time goes by quickly. Mm-hmm. And when I get the reminder, I already know I got to do this right now because I don't want it to go past you. And it's usually a few days, right before it's due, that I receive. So I like the email.
And the portal that we have set up now that anyone can join, basically, it's kind of a self-serve portal. You go on there, you can set up those alerts if that's how you want to get the alerts for text or email instead of us broadcasting to you. But one of the things that Richard said that supports the reason additionally why we want to separate some of these tasks between the accountant and the customer service supervisor is to put more attention on those. And Richard, you keep doing your finance stuff and I'll get somebody over here now that's going to take that and do more of the customer service and try to unlock or stand up some of those services as well to be better customer facing and customer service. That's the whole intent as well. That's supporting this drive.
I mean, I don't have an answer to it. Like I said, I am the non-billing revenue going up like it has. It just amazes me. And I feel bad for those who are in a situation that they don't have a choice but to be late. But when the number was most, two-thirds of the people are paying on time, and one-third is not. I mean, we need to get this money in. And I don't want to keep penalizing people, but I think that I think that Kenneth's suggestions are good. It's just we've got to do something to get people. Now this notification is an upgrade to the system. Do we think we can get to it in the next?
He said you can already set it up yourself.
I believe there's certain notifications, especially the non-payment status,
right,
that if you go click the box on your forehead, I think that's automatic. So it doesn't require any action from my team at all.
To say it bluntly, is the customer, if the customer wants to, if they're just forgetting about it and they want to make sure that they don't have to pay this, they can set that up to help themselves.
For the benefit of the Finance Committee, what I have seen in 18 years, and this is certainly not every customer, but the customers, I don't think it's a situation that our bills, unlike a lot of other bills, come due on a given monthly benchmark. I don't think the problem is that they don't know. Now, occasionally, the time will slip out on them, but as a general rule, I do not think the fees that are being assessed are a lack of notification, a lack of knowledge of the date. I think it is a payment schedule habit, if you will, whatever that habit is driven by, keeping their money as long as they can, maybe cash flow for their purposes, maybe they don't have the money. And I think, especially with non-payments, that is supported by the fact that it's the same people.
Right.
So if you get cut off each month on the 12th, you know what's going to happen on the 12th. And I will say that, you know, with today's technology and everybody having smartphones, if you set a reminder, a repetitive reminder up, you know, there's a certain amount of personal responsibility there. The other thing is we have so many options that do not require the customer. If they forget, we have draft. We have the availability to set up the home recurring that they manage through their portal.
Bill
pay through the bank that's recurring that you can set up. So there's numerous methods. In answer to your question, I hope by next year, if we add this new position, if the Finance Committee and Board approve this new position, I hope that we are going to be in a position next year at this time to be advising the committee on what enhancements we've taken forward that we couldn't get to before. Mm-hmm. I certainly would hope that in a year we could make some significant progress there. Mr. McLam, or Commissioner McLam, one thing I will say about earlier, it's going to be very difficult. I'm trying to keep the committee, it's up to the committee and the board whether you want to raise fees or not. I have no problem with either of those. But it will be very difficult to pull out from those fees, okay, the extra $5 is going to go here, and this $10 originally is going to go here. It's going to be very hard to take that incremental increase and separate it out and put it somewhere for a building or whatever funding you wanted to do. It's going to be hard to pick and choose that. And it will affect your operating because right now those non-payment fees that you see are in the ordinance to pay for operating expenses. Yeah. It's going to be very hard to manage that administratively.
Can I pull it out once a quarter?
You could. Late fees are going to be very difficult. Non-payment would be fairly easy, because you're talking about 75 to 100, so 1/4 of whatever we've done this quarter we can pull out and stick it over here for something. But you're talking about, assuming 125 cutoffs a month, which is, let's say, an average, a reasonable average, at $25 increase for 12 months, you're only talking about $37,000. So it's not going to make a dent, I'm saying, in a $2.7 million depreciation to pull out a quarter of $37,000 a year, right? You're talking less than $10,000 a year, you're going to be pulling out set aside. But we can certainly do cutoffs. It's going to be more difficult when you start talking about a 1.5%. Now we've got to go through the late fees and see how many people pay 15 versus 10. You can't just take the total, because a large chunk of that total is your 1.5% people that you're not raising.
So that number is $150,000 a year, isn't it?
What was that budget number?
You said it was $125 a month times $100.
No, but you're already charging $75, so you're only talking about a $25 increase.
But we're going to take all of it.
Okay, so $37,000.
So it would be $150,000 a year.
No, that's 37 a year. 37.5 a year, I believe. If you take the $25 increase, you're talking about
the whole 100.
He's talking about
the disconnect.
Oh, you want the whole?
The whole 100.
Okay, so you're not talking about segregating the increase. You're talking about the whole disconnect thing now goes to a different purpose. You can certainly do that, but now you've got to accommodate, you don't have enough. Right now it's in your ordinance as an operating budget item. If you're now pulling that out and saying, we're going to designate that for CIP.
So now you're short in your operating.
That's right. Now you don't have $100,000 left to fund your operating expenses for the current year. Right? You'll be okay if you save depreciation because depreciation's in your operating budget. But if you want to pull it all out for, let's say, a new office building, then that sits outside of this operating budget. So now you're taking $100,000 off your books
so
here.
Do you actually depend on that money every year?
It's part of the rate setting process, yes. As you see in this ordinance, it's part of, if you pull it off the ordinance, if I reduce $100,000, $150,000 from your revenues, your non-billable revenues, then what's going to happen? You're going to have a shortfall where your expenses are exceeding your revenues.
And it would increase the fund balance appropriated.
So let me just say this, if I may. I understand where you're driving this. I like the approach. I think that what's a little bit glaring here is that we're using this revenue to offset really what rates should be doing for your operating.
That's correct.
That's what this gets to.
That's correct.
So your fees for your operating should be at a level where you're not relying on this additional revenue that is variable. So it's a variable revenue source.
Right.
That's what Richard's pointing out here, that, really your rate should be structured to support your operating budget, and anything that came in above that could be taken off and put towards a special project, such as you're talking about funding AMI, for example, if that's an initiative we want to move forward with. And then it doesn't hurt your operating budget, because right now we're using it to plug into the operating to make up for rates. So just give that some consideration if you're going to make that change. That's kind of the relationship that the two have together. So,
and to partner off that comment, just a suggestion. So you make sense it is rate driven.
Mm-hmm.
If you wanted to make a decision now, if you want to raise them this year, that's totally fine. But I would say that you may want to leave them in operating revenues for the 26-27 year. And next year, when we're going to have to look at an I-5 debt service rate situation anyway, that would be the year to say, okay, now we want these particular non-billable revenues not to be part of operating. So that we put them through the rate model that way and say, rate model, don't count on this 100,000. You can even say interest income. Now all interest income, I want to go toward a building or whatever purpose. And then you pull them out. Now that will affect your rates because now you have to recoup that hole through your rates. But that would be a more appropriate approach, in my opinion, to picking these non-billable line items out and earmarking them for a specific purpose. Would you tend to agree?
Yes. And if you did raise them this year, you would kind of know better what that revenue looks like coming in this fiscal year. So when we do our projections,
that's correct.
We have that number. Does that make sense? Instead of just a calculation. So
really,
I just pulled it up. Water sewer service charge for disconnection in Durham is $250.
Is that disconnection for non-payment?
There is charge for disconnection of water and sewer lines for non if I don't pay my bill. Yeah?
I just know that, like you just said, we're going out to these homes four times within a month, and we're gassing in $3.50 a gallon now. That's a lot of money we're losing. But the $75 we're charging, we're basically not even breaking even.
Well, with respect to, you're correct. With respect to us doing this review of these values December of this year, that's what this is built on. We didn't calculate $4 a gallon to make up that difference. We try to keep our costs right at what our actual costs are to drive our business out there and do this. And we've been very accurate up until the price increase. So, if there were a slight increase in that fee, that would probably offset some of these additional operating expenses we'll probably see just from vehicle maintenance and gas throughout this next fiscal year. So, not much, but it's there.
Richard, I have a question.
So you went through the process of the late fee and disconnect fee. How one, you know, affects the other. What about if you start, if you start it off with a different date? That wouldn't affect the other things that would just follow.
It would be. So you're saying a different date with the late fee? So let's say you decided I want an extra week for our customers to pay, and I change that 5th of the month to the 12th of the month. Now, to make sure that we've got at least 30 banking days, 30 business days between that 12th and the cutoff day, our cutoff day could not be the 12th anymore, our non-payment fee.
Right.
So we'd have to push that further out. You can do that, but now you're getting into, they're going to have a third deal before a non-payment date occurs. So you're going to increase your bad debt. It's totally, you can totally do that. But you increase your bad debt, and you're pushing it to a time of month where we may be in the middle of a meter removal cycle, meter replacement cycle. So timing-wise, it wouldn't be the most advantageous. If you could just move the late fee day and leave disconnect non-payment day where it was, we've always wanted to do that. I've always said, I wish we could allow 3 or 4 weeks before it's late and then have a much shorter period between cut, but let the general statutes do not allow you to do that if you're an authority. If you're a city, you can.
Yeah, that's why
the term is 21 days.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's why I was wondering if you could,
mm-hmm. It's because it's a city municipality.
Mm-hmm. And when we, just a little background, when we acquired the city of Creedmoor, there was a big customer pushback on this because they were accustomed to the bills going out around the 30th, I believe. They would use somewhere around the 15th. And then they got disconnected, I believe, around the 25th. So you had less than 30 days before cutoff occurred.
Yeah.
And they were saying, yeah, but we used to have 3 weeks before it was late. Now you've only got 2 weeks. Yes, but you also cut off in 4 weeks, and then you cut off in 60 days.
Yeah.
And that's just the difference in the municipality. And so most municipalities back in that day, because I did some research to support it, and back in that day, most municipalities didn't issue a second bill before cutoffs occurred on the prior bill. You only had one bill outstanding.
Okay. So it's nowhere in that cycle to improve the payment day.
Unless we push the other date out as well, that is correct. One pushes the other. You can't compress the time between late and disconnect.
Right. It's just where it falls in the month. Have we killed this dead horse? I don't think so. I think he's still kicking.
This is where the director has to say, I think the finance committee has to make a decision on what they want to do with this. Because it would be a recommendation. The whole budget then comes to the board.
Yeah.
And the whole board would say, oh, I see that you recommended these increases. It would generate that discussion if you wanted to move in that direction. So this is really the appropriate forum to say yay or nay to this item so that we can move on.
I just personally don't think increasing those rates is going to make a change. If you're trying to correct somebody's behavior and deals. That's the purpose.
Right. So the board says, the finance committee says what? That's what we need to hear, a committee person. I need to hear it. Well, I don't need to hear it, but you just if it's either going to be we're going to leave them static or we're going to change them. I think.
I already made my recommendation.
I have to. And I'm okay with Kenneth's recommendation.
Okay. Okay, so that's
$15 for late fee and $100 for the disconnect.
Okay, so that's what the committee has decided then?
I guess. And we'll bring it to the board and see what they say. Okay.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah.
So we're going to the public hearing with the revised ordinance. Right.
Did you want to proportion that increase out as Richard said we would need to do, or you just want to let it remain in the budget?
Remain in operation.
Okay. Just leave it where it is.
Until he said it was better to wait until 26.
And then we'll have the discussion about it as we get into our next fiscal year.
Correct.
Okay.
That's fine. Just for the benefit of the committee now. So when we bring to the public hearing next month, the ordinance won't look like the ordinance you have here. It will increase by those new projections. Just so everybody's on board that why did this number change?
Yeah. Well,
you told us to change it.
And then if it votes down, we'll come back to this one.
Correct.
This proposal.
Correct.
And then I think we have to do a subsequent public hearing. Maybe not. Okay.
Yeah, just one public hearing, and the board can change the ordinance, and then we just bring it back.
Yeah,
by the final approval.
Okay. Okay.
All right. Very good. Well, thank you for that discussion. Item 10, top of page 16, personnel position review. The approved current budget, FY25-26, authorizes 52 full-time positions, includes no part-time or contracted staff, and retains one unfunded position, which is the utility engineer. The draft budget includes a request to reclassify one existing employee to add one new employee. The draft budget proposes adding one full-time accountant, one position. At present, the customer service supervisor is responsible for a significant number of accounts and duties that are normally performed by an accountant one in comparable organizations. As customer service demands and finance department responsibilities continue to grow, it is no longer feasible to combine these functions within a single role. We've laid out for you in detail our request. I provided for you on page 17 a table that shows you visually our board approved FY25-26 full-time equivalents. That's an FTE, part-time is PTE, contracted zero, and unfunded is one is the engineer. So we have not funded the utility engineer in this budget. We continue to hold it in our organizational chart with the hopes and dreams of sometime bringing on a utility engineer in the future, but we're not funding it this year. We're still relying very heavily this year and next year on consultants in our calendar year, so we're just going to continue to proceed in that direction. But I know Chris and I would greatly appreciate having a utility engineer on board.
Are we saving money or spending more money by using the engineering services of the on-call engineers that we have versus our own person?
It's disproportional to, it's apples and oranges, unfortunately, because okay. One person cannot replace the 50 people that are working on our projects, unfortunately. So it's quite an expense. As you're aware, I'm an entire company at CDM Smith behind us on water and sewer and PFAS, and same with two other engineering firms. So if I was to do a comparison for you, we'd probably have a 12-person department.
Okay.
So we find it financially good for us right now to do that. Page 18 is the current org chart. Page 19 is a copy of the current org chart, but it is the proposed 26-27 org chart, and I've highlighted for you further down the page with an arrow. Let's go down. Let's see, Crystal, maybe one more. Yeah, page 19. All right, keep going. Okay, so there you go. So under the finance department, the finance director, you've got the assistant finance director, and then underneath the assistant finance director, we have two pathways. We have add the billing customer service supervisor that you can see in the green box with the red text. And that supervisor will be managing our utility billing specialists and our customer service representatives in the future. So we anticipate that area to be growing. When we talk about expanding customer service activities, that's the area that will be growing. The accountant one is a reclassifying an existing position. It falls into the second pathway under the assistant finance director. Suffice to say, you'll probably end up in the next 10 years with additional accountant ones, accountant twos, accountant threes, account clerks in that area too, potentially, just as we expand. We tend to do more of the expansion in that area under the finance department versus other models that Richard and I have talked about where you place accountants and accountant technicians in the department itself. There's opportunities to do that, but we seem to like this streamline right now, all within this finance department, if you will. And with our technologies the way they are now, you don't necessarily need to seat somebody 2 miles away in a department, you can pretty much put them behind a computer and they have access to all the information that they need, voice and data. So this is what our proposed chart is for your consideration. And just above the chart, a little bit scrolled so we can see the top principal, if you would please. So there's the unfunded position there for the utility engineer, just so that you can see that position. Sits there, and Chris manages for us the assistant director, the HR manager, as well as the utility engineer if we had one, but he manages everything underneath that, including all of our distribution, water treatment plants, our project management inspector, and our wastewater treatment plant superintendents.
Did you just say Chris manages the HR manager? Because I'm not understanding how this line goes. It looks like they're still direct reports to you.
Well, they do, but I have a sub-assignment. So I take on one half of the organization. I have all the oversight of the organization, right. Number one, but I've assigned to Chris to manage the oversight, direct oversight right now of HR on a daily basis for me, and he does utilities, and I take care of everything else, finance, customer service, primarily all the capital that's going on, all the projects that are going on, so.
All right.
You want something? Fantastic job. As every year, I know it's hard to put more on the ratepayers, but we don't have a choice. And I know with the PFAS situation coming up, we're not going to have a choice. I would love to see us get plenty of grant money and move forward, but we can only hope and pray. Thank y'all for everything you do and organization all the way down.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I just, finance committee meetings are so informative, and it's a shame that they're open to the public and the public isn't here, because this is such an informative meeting, and people need to understand it, and we need to understand. That's why we have the public hearing before we go to our budget. But I look forward to these meetings every year and understanding where we are and what we can do to be better. And I appreciate all the time and energy that goes into this. And I just want to say thank you.
I wanted to say thank you also. We had another great productive meeting, and it's great to know that we do not have to increase rates, and that's going to be exciting to share. I am going to check out the SEF portal a little bit more than what I use and see how it can be maneuvered a little bit more. Maybe I can share some information later with everybody. It would, like Georgiana mentioned, it's nice to have the public here, and it would be greater if when we had our monthly meetings that they would be here, they could learn some helpful tips about their bill. But again, thank you so much. Each one has put 100% plus effort in this meeting, and we greatly appreciate it. Would you like to comment?
I do have a comment. Is there anything, Chris, you would like to add?
I'm sorry.
Richard?
Sorry.
Ruben?
No, just thank you for your words.
Okay. So, next steps, something I may cover. So, as far as we understand, not a whole lot of changes in the proposed budget that we presented today. There were two items I think we had, and we just covered those as far as the late fee and the non-payment fee. So, you're on board with that, correct?
Yes.
Which is good. So thank you very much for that. We will work towards, I'm looking at my budget schedule here, a public hearing for a tentative budget adoption by the board at the April 14th board meeting. Okay, so that will be the regular board meeting on April 14th, and within the agenda we have an item for the public hearing. So that all resides within that. So Commissioner, I'll get together with you as well if you want and cover that. We look at publishing the public hearing notice on about April 2nd, and that's about the same time that the budget books would come to the board members. So what we do is we provide the budget books to the board members
And we also make it known, we notify the public on our website and via the newspaper that the budget books are available, the draft, and the public hearing is coming up. So that's what's in front of you once we get to April. So in the next several weeks, we go through, Richard goes through finishing up the budget and producing a lot of materials for us to get us ready for that meeting. So what you can anticipate at the April board meeting is the opportunity for me to present the budget as I did from the statement that provides all the information, the budget message. So I read through all of that, and then there's an opportunity then for the entire board finance committee to talk about anything that they want with the ordinance or anything that we presented. Once that concludes and closes out, we then move to the public hearing. That's the next item on the agenda. We do that for a couple of reasons. It gives the entire board an opportunity to hear and see the budget, as well as anyone that's in the audience. They get educated during that hour as well before the public hearing. And then it gives the opportunity for those that want to participate in the public hearing to come up and say what they want to say. But getting that education overview, the board has thought was a great idea. So that's what to anticipate coming up in April, in addition to some regular business items that we have scheduled for you. Any questions or comments? If not, I will rest. And I just want to say we thank you very much for your time today and your direction.
Thank you. Questions or comments?
So moved.
Second.
All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Have a great weekend.
Thank you. You as well.